Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When Shorts Were Short only concerns itself with what was actually a very narrow window in football history when teams wore, well, short shorts, the podcast will only cover football from 1954 when Umbro made their first England kit with shorter shorts, a design that was widespread within English football by the mid-50s, to 1992 when short shorts were all but finished as Umbro's baggy shorts for Tottenham's new kit ahead of the 91 FA Cup final quickly caught on. I'm Daniel Ruiz Tyson. This is When Shorts Were Short. If the shorts weren't short, we don't talk about it. Gary Thompson, despite playing for nine clubs, for most of us, unless you're affiliated to one of those nine clubs, will evoke memories of late 70s, early 80s Coventry City and that beautiful Admiral sky blue kit with the gorgeous black and white tram lines. Socks rolled down, his all-action style was a nightmare for defenders, and off the pitch, I think it's fair to say this striker, an exuberant Brummie, might have been viewed as a lovable rogue by a chunk of his managers. A bad early injury at Coventry, as he tells us, probably means that he never realised his full potential, but he still went on to star at a number of top-flight clubs, probably peaking at a struggling West Brom side in the mid-80s when his form was good enough for him to be considered for England. And this childhood Villa fan who idolised Brian Little growing up would later go on to be part of the Villa side that came back up in 88 under Graham Taylor, as well as having a key role as an elder statesman in his final years at Palace and QPR. This is Gary Thompson. How did the book come about? Had you been looking to write one for a while?
No, the answer to that is no. I've always told stories. When I was at Coventry as a kid, we'd be travelling on buses and travelling all over the place for ages and that. And they'd always sit there and they'd be going, Tom English and all them. Go on, they call me Benson, because Benson was a black butler back in the day. And they call me Benson. So, Benson, tell us a story. And so I'd just be making up these fantastical stories and just passing time. But I never, ever thought about writing a book. Bill Howell, who wrote the book with me, who was the genius behind it, really, the brains behind it. Bill, I used to watch a lot of football with Bill. He's a writer for the Evening Mail. And I wasn't right for the Evening Mail. And Bill used to say to me every now and again, you should be on the TV, you should be on the radio, you know football, blah, 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 you're personable. And then 2 or 3 years ago, even Stuart Curtis of Curtis Sports got hold of me and said, like, you know, you should write a book. And I weren't that interested. And they mentioned it a couple more times. I ended up going to the publishing house, having a look around, they had a chat, started telling them a couple of stories. And before you know it, I'd sort of half agreed, went for a beer, as you do to seal the deal. And that was me done. And then I thought, this is going to be murder, because obviously I'm going to have to, I got a dictaphone, and any stories I could remember, I'd tell Bill them. I'd put them in a dictaphone. Bill would ask me questions. He'd do research. And so we'd meet every 6 weeks and basically talk about myself for 2 or 3 hours. So as you can imagine, I thoroughly enjoyed it after that.
It's interesting because, let's say your era, your late 70s to early 90s. And yeah, if we go back 20, 30 years ago, it was, as is the case now, perfectly normal for players, current players, to release autobiographies often before they've even finished their career. What I like at the moment is that there are a wave of players from your generation and older who are writing their autobiographies now. And it's making for a better book because you've obviously lived more life. You've accrued whatever wisdom, you know, life, the hard knocks, the highs, all the lows. You tend to be a more rounded person, and you're looking back on your life, not just in football, but your life since football. Obviously, and we'll come to some of the low points, unfortunately, that you cover in your book really eloquently. But do you see an advantage to that? I mean, have you been able to see anything that, looking back at your life in the way that you have, that maybe wasn't so obvious to you as a result of writing this book?
Yeah, a lot of things. I mean, as you say, it's all hindsight. And I'm looking at situations, for example, where I joined the Villa, for example, my time at Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, when I was a player at the time, I was so caught up in it all. And it was everyone else's fault, and this wasn't happening, and that wasn't happening. And when I was older, I'm telling Bill the stories about it. And I remember talking to him about Sheffield Wednesday, and then ringing him about a week later. And I'd be listening to Don Hutchison talk about his time at Hartlepool. And he said, as a young kid at Hartlepool, it was a pure time for him. And it was all he had to do was turn up, train, play football. It was great. And that took me back to my Coventry time. And I played at Coventry with some great players, and I didn't realise how easy the game was. By the time I got to Sheffield Wednesday, I'm older. And I'm more experienced. I'm a record signer. I'm expected to produce. And yet, I've ended up turning the situation that was brilliant into, like, it was Howard Walker's fault. It was Lee Chapman. It was this, it was that. When I thought about it, no, it was my fault. And, like, the book was great in that respect because it let me look back on things and work out situations where I've been a complete ass at times. But, yeah, I'm looking back on my time at Sheffield Wednesday, for example, or the time when I joined Aston Villa. But Sheffield Wednesday, for example, I was the record signing. I'd gone there, I'd scored a lot of goals, I was there to go and produce and take the club to another level. Things never really worked out. I ended up playing up front with Lee Chapman. And when I thought about it, like, it was everyone else's fault. I only stayed there a year. And as I say in the book, I feel like I ran away by joining Aston Villa. But it was everyone else's fault. But when I looked at it properly, I played centre forward with Mark Hatley, with Mickey Ferguson, with Sir Regis, with Les Ferdinand, with Mark Bright. So why couldn't I play with Lee Chapman? The reason why it didn't work out was me. It wasn't Lee Chapman. It wasn't any of them. It was me. I was more amenable to doing it with other players. I should have made the Sheffield Wednesday thing work. So when I turn around and look at it, Sheffield Wednesday not happening, not being as great as it should have been. And it was a fantastic club. We got to the semi-finals of the FA Cup. I think we finished third in the league. We had a great year. I just never scored the goals that I wanted to score. So we're talking about my ego again. I look at it, and I suppose now I'm older, and the prime example, I can look at it and say, yeah, that one's on me.
We'll come to Sheffield Wednesday later because I'm quite interested in the bit in the book where your club, the club of your childhood, Villa, come calling for you and you're not having a great time at Sheffield Wednesday, but you're quite angry that you're having to leave Sheffield Wednesday. We'll come to that later in the interview. Let's go back to the beginning first. Your parents come to England from St. Kitts in the mid-50s. Yeah. You grow up in a big family here. You're born in Kings Heath. Is that just for any listeners who don't know the Midlands? Is that in Birmingham or is it outside Birmingham?
It's in Birmingham. It's about 7 miles from the actual city centre. But most people that are born in Kings Heath are Birmingham City fans. So the strange thing was I ended up becoming an Aston Villa fan, and people thought, yeah, because he wants to be different. The only reason I became a Villa fan, I must have been a complete pain in the ass one day because my Uncle Charlie turned up. And my mum used to work with him at Cadbury's. And she said, oh, your Uncle Charlie's taking you off for the day. And I've gone, all right. So he's took me out, got me togged up and that, took me out. We've got two buses. We've ended up at Villa Park. And he took me and you can smell the hot dogs and all that. Watched the football. Villa were in the old third division. I can't remember who they played, but it's a team that I think they wore yellow. But it was I just loved it. I was into football anyway. I was at ground level. I was watching it. And I thought, oh, I love this. And Uncle Charlie just said, if you behave yourself, we'll bring you back. And so they brought me back a couple of times when I was really on my best behaviour. Then by the time I was 14, my dad took me to see Santos came over after the 70 World Cup. So this would be 72 and played Aston Villa. Pele played and a guy called Coutinho. And I remember watching it and that was me mesmerised. I was done. I was a Villa fan from there. But anyone from our area is usually a Blues fan.
So football is a big thing in your life as a kid. And were you playing with your brothers and other local kids? How did you go from, you know, kicking a ball against the wall to playing in your first teams as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, first, obviously in the book, I've mentioned that Glenn and Blondo came over from the West Indies. And so we've got a couple of additions to what was a ready-made family. Then one day, Glenn's playing in the back garden. We had a fair-sized back garden.
Sorry, just for anyone who hasn't read the book yet, these were half brothers, half sisters, or
no, full.
I mean, okay, so they just hadn't come over originally with your parents.
Yes.
Okay,
when my mom and dad had them, then they had to leave them behind to come to England to make a living, a life for themselves, then to pay to bring them over. By which time, they'd had another three children. So then as I say in the book, these two kids turn up who are older than us, obviously, and they speak, not patois, but they speak with a little lingo, and we took the mickey out of them repeatedly. But anyway, Glyn was playing football with Ian one day in the garden. Ian's my older brother who passed, and I wanted to get involved. This thing was fascinating. I wanted to get involved in it, and they wouldn't let me play. So, as I say, I did what any self-respecting eight-year-old would do. I went and cried to my mum, who then insisted I'd be in the game. They then would let me play, but they'd lean on me and they'd be a little bit more aggressive with me because they didn't really want me involved because I was like the third wheel, wasn't I? But I loved it. I loved the aggression. I loved playing. And then from there, our kids of our age, we'd get a ball and we'd get to the park. Now, if there's four or five of us go to the park, there would always be a game of football on. Loads of kids would come up. You'd end up chatting. You'd have a bottle of dandelion and burdock. You'd have your sandwiches. You'd be out for the day. And you'd have a massive game of football. There'd be about like 30 a side. And that's how the homie skills, but that's how I became half decent because I played with bigger and older kids all the time because I was the second youngest.
There wasn't much football on TV aside from you know, the highlights at the weekend. So who were the footballers, whether they were Villa players or players elsewhere, that you loved watching or hearing or reading about as a kid?
I loved obviously reading about George Best because George Best at the time, he was different. He was a maverick. He could beat people. He scored goals and that. Plus, he had long hair and he was just different. And not so much Bobby Charlton, although everyone thought Bobby Charlton was a great footballer. Loved Dennis Law, Francis Lee, Rodney Marsh. I just loved someone different. I remember seeing, I could only have been about five or six. I remember watching, because my dad would watch the cup final and you'd watch from about 10 o'clock till after the cup final. It was on all day. And I remember Leeds played Liverpool in the cup final and there was a black guy playing for Leeds. Johansson, so a black guy, white kid, Albie Anderson. And that caught me eye and that stayed with me for years. And I always remember that. And I suppose he was obviously one of my first heroes. By the time I started playing as a kid, Clyde Best starts playing at West Ham. Adi Koker starts playing at West Ham. And then after that, obviously, Laurie, John Chidozie breakthrough, Brendan Batson, Viv Anderson. And so, but when I was a young kid, I saw the Brazil team in the 70s and I fell in love with that side. But as you say, there wasn't an awful lot of football. So we'd get match of the day, you get the cup final day, but you wouldn't get an awful lot of football. And the Villa players, Brian Little, George Best was the man, but then this kid called Brian Little turned up at Villa and had the same sort of long hair, was different, could dribble and beat people. And so we all just loved Brian Little. We all want to be Brian Little. He was my hero. Well, he is my hero. And I did a couple of Q&As with him and he couldn't understand that I was pretty quiet. But it's hard to say, well, actually, because I'm sitting here with my hero, like, but after a bit, he sort of realised, and Brian's been brilliant with me. But yeah, there was lots of players, because every team had a star, didn't they? Every team had, like, Stan Bowles or someone like that, Tony Curry. So you liked someone who was slightly different from the norm.
Just before we come to your career taking off at Coventry, it's the mid-70s period where black English players are really starting to establish themselves in English football, but they're having to endure horrendous abuse, which would be around certainly for the duration of your career. Now, you're a little younger than the likes of the late Cyril Regis, for instance, who you later link up with at West Brom.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask, as mentioned a few minutes ago, there wasn't much football on TV. There was plenty of it on the radio. Obviously, you could read about it. But I don't remember broadcasters picking up too much on the racial abuse during that time. So as a young black player coming into the game, did you have any idea of how bad the abuse might be prior to playing for Coventry?
I had no idea. I went to Coventry. You'd have little spats at times. You got to remember there's 40, 50 players. And so there's a lot of testosterone flying around. So there would be incidents. There were two black lads, Danny Thomas, who played for England and played with me at Coventry. His brother Valmore was older than me. Valmore was at the club and I joined the club. So it was two black kids. And we'd go away from home at times and you get a little bit of abuse. I remember the first time it really hit home to me, we played Everton in a reserve game and I could only have been about 16. And Everton had a black winger called Cliff Marshall or Clint Marshall. And he came on the pitch and he was booed. We were at Goodison, he got booed. And there must have been about 200 people there. And I couldn't understand what they're booing. Then you looked and realised, and when he touched the ball, they booed him. And that's the first time it really hit home. And then I thought, well, I wanted to be a footballer. And if you're going to boo me, I'm going to annoy you. I'm going to be even worse. So it just fired me up a bit more. by that time, after that, by the time I got in the team, Cyril had exploded, and Viv Anderson had played for England, I think. So being black was kind of vogue, but it was different. And I liked the fact I was different. I liked the fact, like this, you know, in the Westerns, they call them black hats. There's always a bad guy that goes in. Well, I didn't mind being a black hat and people booing me because I felt I could score a goal or I could do something. So I reveled in that a little bit. But by the time I got to West Brom and played with Cyril, he calmed me down and not explained to me, but just showed me how to conduct myself. And I didn't have to be the most aggressive man in the world and all that. And Cyril was the most calming influence on me that I probably ever had. He was brilliant for me.
Well, we'll come to your time at West Brom later during this interview, because that, I think you would agree that that's probably the best time of your career on the pitch. How did Coventry come to spot you?
Right. I'm at school and I think I'm about 11, and we play this team. I play for Kingsleith Juniors. We play a team called Maypole Miners or whatever. And in the dressing room before the game, everyone always talks and that you're getting changed and that. Who's your best player? And they go, oh, Tomo. And so I'm basking in all this. And they say, where's your best player? And they say, they point to this kid. This kid's got to be 6 foot tall. He's got long blonde hair, sideburns, the full bit. And we look and we go, he's a ringer. There's no way that kid's our age. Like, anyway, we all go out to play. So we say to the ref, have a look at this geezer. Anyway, this kid's playing sort of midfield, sort of defensive midfield player, but he's all over the place. Now, everywhere I go, I'm a creative attacking player. Like, everywhere I go, this kid's on me. If I try and beat him for pace, he's read what I'm going to try and do. If I try and beat him in the air, he beats me in the air. Everything I've got, he's got an answer for. So I resort to my default, which is violence, and he slaps me about. So I have the biggest sulk in the world, because for the first time in my life, I've not won a game. I've not scored the goals. I've not been the man. And I sulk for about 10, 12 days. And then I finally, like, just cracked on. As you do, you get over it. I go to Bramwood School. I walk in the first day, my secondary school. And I only went to Bramwood because Bob Latchford and the Latchford brothers went there, and it was a sporting school. And I thought, well, that's the school I've got to go to play more sports and all that. Because that plan was to be a footballer. There was no plan B. I walk in around the corner and there's this kid. And I'm like, you're that lad. And he went, yeah, you're the one that's trying to beat me up. And we both sort of laughed about it. And his name is Paul Dyson. Paul Dyson and myself and a guy called Malcolm Percival become best friends. We become the best three players in our year. And by the time we get to the third year, Paul gets trials for England schoolboys. He goes for the trials. He has the trials and he gets the possible versus probables. He nearly gets there, but doesn't quite get there. Coventry obviously take him on the back of that because all the scouts go and watch trials and that. And they said to him a couple of times, you got any good mates? And he mentioned myself and Percy. They never really did a lot about it. I played for Warwickshire. We played in the English Schools Trophy. We ended up getting to the quarterfinals. Made a name for ourselves. There was a spell where I scored, I think, 4 or 5 hat-tricks or something. And I was in the Sports Argus, which was the Saturday paper. It's big news and that. And like then Jack Hastings spoke to Paul, asked me to go to Coventry on trial. Went to Coventry. They liked what they saw. And I just loved it. I went to somewhere. They took me down initially for, I think it was 2 weeks. Then they took me in the summer holidays. So every day for 6 weeks, all I did, get up in the morning, have my breakfast, go to training. Train morning and afternoon, have my evening meal, hang about with loads of young wannabe footballers, and repeat for 6 weeks. It was heaven. That was it then. I was off and running. And what happened, I ended up, just before the season starts, we have the reserves, or our first team versus reserves, and Ernie Hunt and guest ex-Coventry players. And I'm just sitting on the bench. I'm a schoolboy, minding my own business. And Bert Edwards, the reserve manager, who was our youth team coach as well, he went to me, have you got a goal in you? If I send you on for the last 15 minutes. And me being the shy, retiring fellow, I go, goal, I've probably got a trick looking at me. Like, anyway, I get on the pitch. As luck would have it, I pick the ball up, I go past a couple of players and I smash a shot. Now, anyone that's seen me, I don't score from 30 yards, but I smash this shot 30 yards because he's in the goal. Jimmy Hill's on the mic. What a wonderful goal from one of our young starlets. And what's his name? Thompson. Thompson. Anyway, gets me a name out. That's the Tuesday. Everyone's making a fuss on me. By the Saturday, the regular centre forward, Alan Robinson's had an injury. I end up making my debut in the fifth at 15 in the reserves for Coventry City against Aston Villa. And it's off and running from there. And that's how really I got to Coventry in the space of 6 weeks, went from being a schoolboy to playing reserve football. Paul then made his reserve debut as well. And then the following year, they signed us apprentice and we were off and running.
There's so much young talent coming through at Coventry along with you during that period. You've got Mark Hately, you mentioned earlier, Tommy English, Les Seeley coming through in goal, yeah. Danny Thomas, Peter Bodak, Gary Gillespie and Steve Hunt arrive from Falkirk and New York Cosmos respectively. So young players are being given their opportunities. The downside is that certainly by the early 80s, Coventry become a selling club. As someone who is a first team regular by the early 80s, how did you view that? Did you, on the one hand, say, okay, well, I'm going to get an opportunity here to show what I can do and an opportunity maybe to move somewhere bigger as a result of that? Or were you as a Coventry player frustrated because the potential, there was so much potential there among the kids that perhaps that team had a trophy in it?
That was the most frustrating thing, because at the start of it, we were just desperate to get in the team. The likes of myself, Hately, Tommy English, Gillespie, we just wanted to get in the team and get some games under our belt. We got in the team and the likes of Terry Yarrow, Tommy Hutchison, Jim Holton, they all moved on. So all of a sudden, we were the first team. Now, we're trying to cement a place for ourselves in the league and scoring goals, playing football, winning games. And Gillespie, I think, got called up for the Scotland under-21s. But all we're trying to do is forage a career. So we're cracking on. But all the time, there's always whispers of clubs coming in for people. We signed, I think Jerry Daly was there. We signed Jerry Daly, who was a wonderful player. And then we signed Jerry Francis. Jerry Francis, ex-captain of England, who I've known now since I was 18 years of age. And Jerry said it was the first time he used to take us off. We'd do training. Dave Sexton was a manager. He'd take us off after training, do extra bits of work. And he'd say to me, I'll do some control work around the box. And so I do control and shooting and different drills and that. And he's just said to me, like, all you lot, you don't realise what you've got. The whole world's in front of you. We were like 19. You're playing in the top league. You're scoring goals. You're winning games. Obviously, we were losing games as well. When I looked at it later on, I mean, I got sold to the Albion. But when I looked at it, I wasn't going to go anywhere. I was quite happy to stay there because I felt that two additions to us, we got to the semi-final of the League Cup and the fifth round of the FA Cup. A couple of additions in the right places. That team could have developed and maybe made bigger inroads, maybe won something, but we would have made a big noise. I look at that squad now because most of us played for 20 years. Most of us had very, very good careers. You keep that squad together. I understand why they didn't, because Jimmy Hill lost a lot of money in America and all of a sudden people had to go. But if you could have kept that squad together, who knows what we could have been. But I'd like to think we could have been something special.
Gordon Milne was your first manager at Highfield Road, and he oversaw, yeah, I think, that exciting mid-70s, early 80s era at Coventry. What was your relationship like with him, and what did he do for you as a young player?
Gordon Milne was very dapper, very smart, always polite, always friendly. Ron Wiley, his sidekick, was, and I say this nicely, bully. He bullied me. He made my life a misery. He was always on me. 2 o'clock Thompson had me back in the afternoon to extra training. I thought he didn't like me. But when Ron spoke to me and shouted at me and hollered at me, I proved him wrong. Just went over my head a little bit. If Gordon pulled me one day between the two semi-final West Ham games, and I scored that trick in the first one, one on goal and two proper goals, and we played, I think it was Brighton or Norwich or something like that, on the Saturday before we played the second leg, and I had a bad game. And Gordon called me out in the dressing room. Now, Ron Wiley would always call me out all the time, even when I was doing well. Did Gordon call me out? It broke me up. It was like your dad just saying I was really disappointed how you played. He killed me. And up to this day, Gordon Milne, and I know the family really well. I did something for Gordon the other day. He wanted a number. I would do anything for that man. I love Gordon Milne. He gave me the opportunity. He saw I had something in me. He spoke to me a couple of times. I got sent off in the reserves for throwing a punch, for throwing a punch because I was racially abused. And Gordon explained to me that sometimes you're going to have to bite your tongue a little bit. He just explained to me about being calm. I look up to him. I admire him for what he did for me and what he did for us as a group. He took so much stick. I mean, Gordon Milne's manager now has a young team that would win 2, lose 3, and fans would be on him. And the stick he took at times to protect us is frightening. And like that man, I love Dave Sexton as a manager. I love Gordon Milne as a manager. They did so much for me. I can't thank him enough. Gordon Milne, I love to this day, because Gordon Milne and Ron Wiley, they forged my career. They helped forge what I was going to be as a player and a man.
Your debut comes in March 78 at home to your boyhood club, Villa. I think you lose 3-2. Were you nervous going into that first game, or were you, I mean, you come across as a very confident kid in the book. Did you just take it in your stride?
I was confident in around my own the lads of my age group and that, around the first team, they would have a laughing joke with me and I'd say a little bits, but I wasn't the loud braggart that I am with the youngsters. But I got the chance to play. Mickey Ferguson was injured and I was ready to play. And Frank McGrellis, another centre forward, and we was waiting for the opportunity. We never got the opportunity and we was moaning and groaning that we never got a chance. Tommy Hutchison and all them are going like, we're in the canteen. And they were saying about Gordon, saying, well, Gaffer's picked the team. You're not in it, big man, again. You're not in the squad. What's going on? This was for the weekend before. And I'm like, yeah, I can't believe what's happening. I'm scoring goals in reserves. They say if you score goals, you get a chance. I'm waiting for my chance. I'm running my mouth like for England. Like, anyway, Gordon comes in, doesn't he? And I obviously climb up there. And Tommy Hutchison said, what would you say? I went, nothing. And he went, don't tell us. He's here. Tell him. And Gordon went, you got something to say? So I'm trying to back up now. So stuttering and all. So, no, Gaffer. And he said, get in my office. Took me in the office. And him and Ron had a conversation which went along the lines of, well, do you know, Ron, I understood as a manager of the football club, I picked the team. And Ron went, yeah, that's how I thought it was. But apparently Gary Thompson thinks he picks the team. So he expects to be playing the team. So this conversation's going on over my head. And I'm sitting there trying to go, no, I didn't quite. I'm trying to just weasel my way out of it. They end up saying, well, Coventry play Aston Villa tomorrow at Highfield Road. So we thought it'd be good for Gary Thompson to make his debut at home as opposed to being away. So you're playing tomorrow. Now get out of my office and you better do well. Now I ain't got time to be nervous and that. There was no turn up in the morning. We turned up about 5 o'clock, get ready for the match. I don't have time to be nervous. I've told my mum and dad what's happening and my brothers and that. And then my first touch of elite football, I think Barry Powell rolls the ball to me and he goes under my foot. And I remember thinking, oh dear Lord, after all that, it's just come to this. But within 5 minutes, I was chasing around and I had a decent game, went really well. We got beat by Aston Villa. I think Andy Gray scored 2 wonderful goals that day. Kem McNeil got the other, but just stayed with me. That was it, made me debut, got my first game off and running. And then I got smashed on the Saturday. We played Norwich and I got a tooth knocked out and I did my knee ligaments. But I played on. I just get injected and played till Fergie was back. Because this is my chance. So, yeah, I grabbed the opportunity. I was delighted to get it.
There was a lot of competition up front in that Coventry side. I mean, you had Mick Ferguson and Ian Wallace blocking your path as a kid. But you've also got, in your own age group, you've got Mark Hatley, you've got Tommy English knocking on the first team door as well. Did you view that competition as a positive challenge, or did you, or maybe the other young guys trying to break through, did you think maybe one or two of us are going to have to leave here in order to get an opportunity elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about Coventry, we all knew that by joining the club, there would be a pathway through to the first team. There would be the opportunity. And if you got the opportunity, you had to grab it. But we were looking around because it was hard to get into reserve side. And so Hatley was just behind me and Tom English. They were just behind us. Frank McGrellis was just a year older than me. So Frank McGrellis was the best centre forward, the best touch of any centre forward I've ever seen. Scottish lad, and Frank was the one we all expected to crack on. And so we're waiting for Frank to get his chance. I'm trying to get my chance. Hatley's waiting for his chance. So the competition just spurs you on to make you even better. And that was just midfield, defence, with likes of Gillespie. But up front, we had some strikers, we had some players. It was competition all the time. I mean, when I broke my leg, Hatley came to visit me in hospital, him and Tom English. And I was in the hospital and I thought, I knew they were behind me. I knew they were chasing me. I know my position, but we never really spoke that much. Then all of a sudden, I broke a broken leg. I'm in hospital. They come to visit me. And I sat there and I thought, that's nice, isn't it? They come to visit me. And then when they left, and I thought about it after, and I thought, weasels, they've come to see how long I'm going to be out for, because I've opened the door for them to step in. The end of that season, which you say a few weeks later, I end up getting the Young Player of the Year award. So I get on the pitch. I got hip to toe plaster, get on the pitch, take me award and all that. Coventry are playing Wolves. I think they beat them 3-0. I think Mark scores, but Mark has an unbelievably good game for his debut. And remember, I was pleased for him, but it's kind of burnt because I've got a broken leg. I can't compete against him. I remember after the game saying, well done and that. Ron Wiley comes up to me and Ron knows how to push me buttons. And Ron went to me, well, son, how do you think he did? I went, yeah, he did very well, like. And he says, yeah, it's funny that. He says, there's one door opens, another one slams right in your face. And he went off laughing. And I was fuming because I couldn't even get fit. I had to wait 11 months. But bit by bit, Mark and myself became quite friendly. I got very friendly with Tom English. But the rivalry was always there. We always wanted to compete against each other. But I think it spurs you on. I mean, nowadays, players don't seem to like it if someone comes to their club because their nose gets pushed out of the joints. It made us better players.
What did you learn as a youngster from the likes of the senior pros? Because there were some tough characters in that Coventry dressing room. You had Terry Yorath, Jim Holton, Tommy Hutchison, yes. Nick Coop. And later on in your career, towards the end, the early 90s, you're going into clubs like Palace and QPR. You're what these days would be regarded by then as a squad player. You're there to look after the youngsters. Was there anything you learned from your early days at Coventry in that dressing room that you later used when you were the senior player in the dressing room?
Huntie will say the same thing. I think he did one with Huntie not long ago. He walked into that dressing room and it was brutal. But I walked in at 15 years of age and I just remember sitting there one day and the stick was flying about, the slightest thing. And I remember sitting there saying, don't say anything. Don't get drawn in. Don't get involved in that. Because you say something, it's on you. People will just rip you the slightest thing. And I just learned that not everybody copes with that. And like as I got older, I just wanted to make sure anyone that came to any club I was at was looked after, felt comfortable. Because the first day anywhere is the horrible situation. And get to know people again is a horrible situation as well. And it's difficult. And I just wanted to make sure anyone comes to the club that I'm going to look after him. Andy Gray came to Aston Villa with Stuart Gray. They join Aston Villa. McAnally comes to Villa. And we look after him. We make sure they feel comfortable. They're not on their own at any time unless they want to be. I just want people. This was the best time of our lives. We were playing football, scoring goals. We were meeting girls. We were doing all sorts. This is fun time because I realised soon after when I stopped playing and had to work for a living, how grossly overrated working for a living is. Now, that football was unbelievably so good for me. And I realised how lucky I was. And I just wanted to make sure everyone appreciated me, enjoyed the time they had. One thing I did learn, that by the time I went to Palace and Cardiff and places like that, or even Watford, I was the daddy. I was one of the senior players and I would just want to make sure people was comfortable being in the club and enjoying what they were doing because it was a wonderful time.
We've got questions throughout this interview from listeners. The first one here, Adidas Tango 78. I think this is a good observation. They say there's this thing about English football of that era, strike partnerships, usually involving the classic big man, little man dynamic. But through your career, you, a classic British centre-forward, all action, tall, strong, were lining up alongside fellow big centre-forwards. At Coventry, there's you and Hateley. At West Brom, at least initially, it's you and Cyril Regis. Shepherd Wednesday, you've got Lee Chapman, who you mentioned earlier. Later at Villa, you've got, I think you're there originally, aren't you, when you've got the first Andy Gray, the Scottish Andy Gray.
Yes,
And later, you've got Alan McAnally. So, that's a good observation. There weren't too many big man, little man partnerships in your career, were there? You were playing with big centre forwards, similar style to yourself. How did that work?
I think it just came about because I was mobile and most of the centre forwards I played with was mobile as well, but I could cover ground. And when I first got in the team, I played with Ian Wallace and that was a typical big man, little man. Fergie was injured. That's what got me first opportunity. But after a bit, I played with Fergie. I played with Hateley at Coventry as well. And we were both, Mark Hateley was very, very quick and very mobile, moved well in the box as well. And our partnership linked well. We linked well together. And I never thought about big man, little man. We were both mobile strikers who could cause problems, going behind, receive the ball to our feet and bring people into play as well. So we could do a bit of everything. By the time I get to play with Cyril looked like a target man, but he played like an inside forward or a centre, like inside left or something. He was quick, he was strong, but he could beat people and he could score goals, outpace people and all that. I just adapted my game to people because I was not football bright, but I was clever enough to realise that if he wins the end, I've got to try and get on the end of it. Like, I've got to do the little man role or he'll do the same for me. But the two big men usually works. The chappy with Lee Chapman, I didn't say it didn't work. We worked very well. I just never scored enough goals. And that always annoyed me because all through my career up until then, I scored goals. So it bothered me. Like, but then, as I got older, goals weren't the be-all and end-all. I love scoring goals and that, but I want to bring players through. I want to develop with players. I want the team to win. I want the team to benefit. So, yes, the observation is spot on. I played with lots of big men. I enjoy playing with big men, but I was a mobile striker, so it didn't matter if I was playing a big man or a little man because I covered ground, got around the pitch.
80-81, I think before Coventry win the 87 Cup final, 80-81 was the season for Coventry fans that they often get nostalgic about. Before we come to the League Cup semi-final, Coventry, you do lose a lot of experience that season and maybe just the season before. You've got Terry Yorath had moved on to Spurs the season before. Then you've got Ian Wallace, Tommy Hutchison, Bobby McDonald, Jim Holton. They all go. It's a great opportunity for the kids to establish themselves. But at the same time, you'd lost all that experience in one go. How much did that impact the team looking back?
Looking back, it impacted us a lot. We had hundreds and hundreds of games experience that just went out the door. I mean, the likes of Mick Coop was there as well. Mick Coop must have played, I'd say, about 400 or 500 games for Coventry City. Then he goes to Derby County, stays at Derby for about a year, doesn't really hack it anywhere else after that because Mick Coop was Coventry City. Hutch goes, Yorath goes, Barry Powell goes, Bo McDonald, Jim Brogan had been there, he's left, Jimmy Blythe goes. And all of a sudden, all that experience goes. But we've got young, hungry kids who are desperate for the opportunity. So we were always liable to get battered 3-0, 4-0. But we always like the chance to win a game as well. So we were learning as we were doing the job, as it were. And so it was a great learning experience. We could have done with a bit more experience in there. I think Jerry Francis came and helped us a lot. But to be fair, we needed more experience to guide some of the youngsters along. But it was sink or swim. And most of us realised this was a great opportunity. And many clubs, you're never going to get that. In what is now the Premier League, a load of kids just getting a chance to play would not happen. So we made the most of it. We had some good players. We learned from very good experienced players, and we tried to teach. By the time kids came to the club, Jim Melrose came and Tom English went to Leicester. We tried to make Jim really comfortable. Jim scored a hat-trick on his debut. He's done the article, I owe it all to Tomo, blah, blah, blah. Jim Melrose, brilliant, great striker, lovely fella. But I would imagine Jim would say from the day he walked in the club, he felt comfortable. We made him feel comfortable because I knew how horrible it was starting out of Coventry. And so anyone walked in, it was good for him. But yeah. It was a great opportunity and it probably will never happen again. People talk about the Busby Babes or the Class of 82. It was sort of a bit like that, but it's sort of a lower down version with Coventry. But it was an experience that I love. I'm glad I had it, grateful I had it. And I just, not worry, but I think about like Jerry Francis who had to come in and help a bunch of kids get by. And he, ex-captain of England, it must have been murder for him at times, trying to explain to us and help us along and all that, because we were full of it as well. But it was a great experience. It won't happen again. And I'm just grateful for the opportunity.
There's a brilliant League Cup semi-final tussle with West Ham in 80-81. And yeah. I think we've got to put this, give it some context, because on the one hand, you've got this very young Coventry team and West Ham are the second division team. But that West Ham second division team was no ordinary second division team. They'd won the FA Cup the season before. They were running away with the second division title that season. They'd got to the last eight of the European Cup Winners' Cup. They're going to take Liverpool to a replay in the League Cup final. I've spoken to West Ham players who played in both that second division side and the 86 side that finished third. And to a man, they've all said that the second division West Ham was actually the stronger team. So it's almost men against boys in that semi-final. Having said that, you win the first leg 3-2 at Highfield Road with two goals from yourself and another from Jerry Daly. Is that one of the high points of your career? Certainly your time at Coventry.
My time at Coventry, yes, definitely. I mean, leading up to the game, I think I played in the first round or third round, whatever it was, at Cambridge. And then I had a hand injury. I got stamped on by Larry May. Had an operation. Well, took about 2 weeks before they realised something was wrong with me. Got rushed in for operation. Couldn't play for a couple of weeks. So I ended up playing that season with a plaster on my hand. So leading up to it, I think I played the quarterfinals against Watford. We drew 2-2 at Vicarage Road. We smashed them 5-0 at Highfield Road. And all of a sudden, the buzz is in there. We're into the semi-final. We get to play this West Ham side. And we never really worried about the fact that they were an experienced side. They had like players like Billy Bonds and people like that. They had a very, Devonshire, they had a very, very good team. But there was no worry from us because we just thought over two legs, with our young legs and enthusiasm, as long as we didn't do anything stupid, we had a chance. And then we start the game within 10, 15 minutes. I can't remember. Was it Billy Bonds as a header? And Les Seeley tries to catch it, but he squirms under him.
He looks round.
Yeah, and he tries to look round and try to get away with a goal. Ref lies with us, give it anyway. So goal, 1-0 down. So not a problem. We're 1-0 down. But we're young. We're full of enthusiasm. We've got a game and a half to go and get back in this game. So there's no problem. It's not a massive worry. Like, the fans are right behind us. And then they get a throw in. And I clock Devonshire going to receive the ball. And I don't know I should be in and around that area, around the halfway line. But he takes a touch. I nick the ball off him, but I end up now going back to my goal. As I look up, Les Seeley's in goal. So I think in them days, you could roll it back to the keeper. So I roll it back to, I look down, roll it back to the keeper. As I roll the ball to the keeper, Les, God rest his soul, is standing right next to me. So as the ball rolls into the empty net, Les goes, keepers. So I slump on the floor, and then, like, I've never seen this, but people say, like, because my girlfriend was in the stand and she was crying and all that. But people, like, Les, being typical keeper, just go, oh, I'm dealing with idiots, that sort of thing. Like, I'm on the floor, I get up. People are like, oh, my God, we're 2-0 down. So that is a mountain to climb. We get through to half-time. I walk in at half-time, and I think first thing I'm going to do is apologise, blah, blah, blah. Ron Wiley, sit down, sit down. Him and Gordon proceed to give the best talk ever about trusting your teammates. You're in this together. Look to your left, look to your right. These players you grew up with now, this is a great opportunity. We're 2-0 down, so what? The next goal is what's going to decide it, and we're going to get the next goal. Anyway, by the time we walk out there, we're like, yeah, there's a chance to get this game. Like, we got a chance. Anyway, from what I remember, Andy Blair picks the ball up and he plays a through ball. I outpost the back four, Bonzi and all them are old ass. And I get there just before Phil Parks, touch it in. I'm in the goal, giving it the Yukini. 2-1. 15 minutes later, whatever it is, Danny Thomas picks the ball up, comes inside on his left foot, by the way, could have gone anywhere. Smashes a shot, Phil Parks saves it, Jerry Daly taps it in 2-2. And then the crowd is buzzing, and that atmosphere, second half, all I can remember is the goals and a buzz. That the whole thing went by so quickly. Before I knew it, the final whistle had gone. We were standing in the middle of the pitch, thanking the fans for coming, applauding the fans and that. It was an unbelievable night. Big John Sillett rushes up, picks me up, hugs me, and everyone goes absolutely mad. But the third goal, in Coventry had an indoor gym. And every training session at the ground, myself and Tom English, they had numbers on the walls. And we'd smack a ball to each other, turn and shout a number. You'd hit the number 10 or number 5 and that. Anyway, I think it's Hunty. Hunty's running with the ball, Steve Hunt. And he carries the ball, and I make an angle for him to play it to me to bounce it off. And he carries on, so I move again. Plays the ball to me this time, and I try and turn with the ball. And my actual turn, if you look at it, I push the ball too far. But I'm that quick, I'll get onto it. And I hit it into 5, into the corner, beat the keeper, we win 3-2. So it all works out beautifully, all comes together. And from that, I got my England call up, under-21s call up. They called me up before, but I broke my leg, so I'd lost a year. Got me call up, got in the England squad. We ended up winning the European Championships. From that moment, I was like, big news. I went for an Indian meal a couple of nights later with my girlfriend. And I walked in a restaurant and everything went quiet. I went into shop, everything went quiet. And I said to my girl, if this is what being famous is like, I don't really like it. I'd rather like just melt, you know, melt into the background. But yeah, it was Coventry fans talk about it. I think there's a book out called 29 Minutes from Wembley. We were so close and we should have got there. We went to West Ham. I think it's 0-0 at half time. And we're saying, I think Mark had 2 chances in the first half. And we're saying, we get another chance, we'll finish this off. But I think Jimmy Neighbour scores the goal of the death and we get beat. But we should have got to Wembley. If we got to Wembley, we play Liverpool. Who knows what would happen? But all of a sudden, we're on the map.
And that second leg, you write in the book, was played in one of the most intimidating atmospheres you'd ever encountered as a player. How did you deal with that on the night? How did that young Coventry team deal with playing at in front of such a hostile crowd that particular night?
I think up until we got there, we didn't realise how bad it would be. I had a bit of hate mail because we get loads of letters. Can you sign this? Can you sign this? Blah, blah, blah. I got some letters and that sort of thing's never really bothered me. So I got these letters and I would sit there and I'd have about 6 or 7 letters and I was throwing them into the bin. And Danny Thomas, what are you doing? He says, oh, I've got some mail. And he read one of them and it really upset him. And then I looked and thought, it must be really upsetting them, but it never bothered me. I'm like, you're right. But maybe I'm dense in that respect. I'm unsensitive enough to get too bothered about it. I'll prove you wrong. Anyway, we get to West Ham. The Coventry fans, we find out later, they get stoned. The coaches get stoned. The atmosphere is so intimidating. We go out to warm up. I remember someone passed the ball. It went past me and went out to go off the pitch. So I went to go off the pitch to get it. And all of a sudden, the hate I felt of these people, and we used to call them donkey jackets because they all seem to have donkey jackets, like, you know, oh, how you doing, son? One of them, like, and I just saw all these geezers and they try and pull me in. I'm like, you can have that, leave the ball. And I went to the middle of the pitch, I'm like, Jesus, have you seen that? And the only other place I experienced that was Millwall with the Albion. We had the same sort of thing. We got beat 3-1 there. It was pure hatred. And I don't think it was even racially, it was just hatred. And like for that, they loved their team and they hated everybody else. But that atmosphere then was as intimidating, as horrible as I ever known. And as a group, we just had to bond together. And I think maybe the atmosphere made us freeze a little bit because we had 2 or 3 chances early on. If we get one of them, we kill the atmosphere. But we didn't take the chance and they managed to get through. Like,
You mentioned the England under 21s a couple of minutes back. At that stage of your career, given the upwards trajectory of your early years, and also at West Brom, where you come close to a full cap because you really do find your goal scoring boots at West Brom. In this first half of your career, was winning a full England cap a target? And why do you think it never happened, especially given your form for West Brom?
Yes, it was a target. From being a young kid, I think a couple of Coventry lads got called up for England Youth. Gary Gillespie and Andy Blair got called up for Scotland Youth and the under-21s. I got called up for the under-21s, broke my leg. So from then on, I wanted my cap. I want an opportunity to play against the top players. So I get the under-21s, I get my cap. I play, I do quite well. I think I scored 3 goals in 6 or 8 games or something like that, I can't remember. But I score a few goals. Everything goes really well. I'm looking to make the progression onwards. And I remember we won the European Cup, the championship, should I say, and Ron Green with the England managers at the dinner. And as he's talking, he gets up and he says, "Well, it's been a lovely occasion. Well played, lads, blah, blah." And he's going through the full bit. So we're all sitting at the table listening to him. There's me, Adrian Heath, Vincent Eyre and all that. He turns around, Paul Goddard, unbelievable footballer, Clive Allen. And he goes, "Look around." He says, "Some of you will move on from here, under-21s, be the England B, be in the full side. Some of you will fall by the wayside. But this is a special moment. Enjoy the moment." And I remember jokingly talking to Sammy Lee and all them, going like, "Well, I feel sorry for you, lads," said. Because obviously, as far as I can know, I was going to get me cap, weren't I? And as it turned out, it did work out like. And funny enough, a year later, or 2 years later, I'm at the Albion. And at the time, it was around Christmas. And I'm the top scorer in the division. And Bannister and Waddle, I knew Waddle as a kid at Coventry. Bannister, I knew at Coventry. We're all chatting. We're playing Newcastle. We put before the game at the Hawthorns, we're having a chat. So we're having a chat and Bannister says, "Have you heard the word? Two of us are going to get called up. One for the B side, one for the full side." And like, I just jokingly went, "So which one of you is going to get the B call up?" Because we all know who's getting the full cap. As it turns out, one got the full, Bannister got the B, I got nothing. But I think my natural aggression, Ron Greenwood spoke to Dave Sexton one day when I was at Coventry and I played against Brighton and Steve Foster, who's a lovely, lovely bloke, good centre-half, played for England. Steve Foster's smashing me. The ball's up the other end. He keeps headbutting me and booting me. And he went on a couple of times. And I said to Fozzie, "You do that again, I'm going to lay you out." "Yeah, all right." Carries on, headbutts me again. So I turned and smacked him one in the face. Fair play to him. He never moved. He never fell down. He just got on, shrugged it off. Ball comes off. We go chasing the ball. We go and start playing that. Dave Sexton calls me in on a Monday. "How do you think you did?" "Thought I did all right, gaffer." He says, "Yeah, the England manager was there." I says, "Yeah, I heard he was there, like, you know." So what's he say? He says, "If you go to an Iron Curtain country and you turn and smash their centre-half in the face like that and he goes down, you're getting sent off and you're getting vilified by the English public. You cannot do that sort of thing." And I went, "Yeah, but Fozzie was headbutting me and booting me and all that." And he went, "They don't see that. All he saw was you throw an arm at him." And I was like, "All right." And I think my aggression, I think there might be a worry it might overspill. But also, there were some great strikers in around that time as well. The likes of Mariner and, like I say, Clive Allen, Goddard, Gary Shaw. There were some very, very good strikers as well. And to be honest, even though I scored a lot of goals at the Albion, I probably wasn't quite good enough to be the full cap. I think I should have got one cap, but I don't think I was wanted to carry on for 5 or 10, 15 caps, you know what I mean?
Gordon Milne is moved upstairs in the summer of 81, and Dave Sexton, who you've just mentioned, he arrives as manager from Manchester United. He sets about pulling your game apart. What was he trying to do with your game, and how receptive were you to those changes he was trying to bring about?
I knew Dave from the under-21s the year before. I remember scoring, I think I scored 1 and Adrian Heath got 2, or I got 2 and Adrian Heath got 1 against Romania on my debut. And I remember after the game, Dave calling me over and pulling out a toffee. He said, "Yeah, son, have that." And I was like, "Oh, cheers." And they went, "He don't give out his toffees unless you've had a really..." He used to hand out toffees if you had a good game. And I went, "All right." So I got the old Sexton toffee. So all of a sudden, me and Dave Sexton are cool. Next thing, he comes as manager. So like, we start working, and I remember him pulling me one day, and he always used to cut out, you know, like players look at videos now, the analysis of different players and that. He'd show me bits about like Puskas or Eusebio, and it'd be like little video clips that he'd cut out and say, "Look at that. Look at him breaking forward from midfield. Look at him making a run across the box and into across the centre half to head a ball in the box and that." And he'd show me stuff all the time. He'd take me away and watch videos, and he said, "Now we've got to do, what I've got to tell you is you're always aggressive. You're always tense all the time. You've got to learn to relax to receive the ball. So sometimes you, you're soft and relaxed and sometimes you're aggressive. And he was trying to show me that football wasn't just smash all the time and crash into people. Sometimes you got to be thoughtful about how you're going to play, because sometimes you meet someone who's stronger than you and quicker than you, and you're going to find a way to get around you. And so in the end, he broke my game down. As a centre forward, I need to work on my touch. I was very quick before I broke my leg. Afterwards, I was quick, but I wasn't the rapid quick kid I was before that. But just receiving the ball, mental awareness, pulling into different areas, thinking centre-halves. If the centre-half had me number, in a certain respect, then I had to find a way to get around him, either come short, spin him behind, or go away, receive the ball to feet, pop it off first time and move again. He showed me different things, but loads of different things. He had me taking corners one day with the outside of me boot. Laurie Cunningham did it for Real Madrid. So he's got me, Haitley, and we're taking corners with the outside of our boot. And where we were at Coventry, there's a place called Massey Ferguson, which used to make the cars, which was on the hill, right? So they could see us training. So he took six of us out there. We were smashing balls outside of the boot. And then he had us dancing over a football without touching the ball, dancing for a minute. Now, it does sound a long time. Dancing without touching the ball, he looked ridiculous. So these guys are working. Is this what you lot do for a living? And that? And they just taking a mickey. And we're like, Gaffer, can we give it? Keep going. 25 seconds, keep going. And all just stuff like that. But he showed me so many different things that at the time I was like, oh, we're doing this for? Because I am one of life's moaners about everything anyway. But when I got older, when I played more, went to different clubs and that, I could see things falling into place. Oh, right. I saw Dave Sexton when I was scouting. I introduced my lad to him and I said, like, this is one of the greatest coaches you will ever meet. And my boy went, who is he then? Because I think the FIFA had just come out and all that. Is he on FIFA? Well, that's Dave Sexton. But Dave was like a wonderful, wonderful coach. And as a geezer, we fell out. I had an incident with a girl in the hotel and it broke his heart. But we made up a few weeks later, and fair play to Dave, never bore a grudge. He was brilliant. And when I got sold, I was sold from under him. And then he realised the writing was on the wall. But as a manager, he was the perfect man to take a young side, keep it in the division and move it on. Gordon become general manager, but Dave was brilliant as a coach and tactician, brilliant.
A couple of things I picked up on there. First of all, you mentioned that Dave Sexton, when he arrived, told you, I'm paraphrasing here, that perhaps you were maybe, you know, too full on at times, too angry at times. You've said at the start of this interview that when you got to West Brom, Cyril Regis basically tells you the same thing. So that's really interesting that two different people have picked up on that and shown you how to work on that. The second thing, though, which I find really interesting, and it does happen sometimes with very young players, I think Whiteside was a case in point before he even got into the United side. He had an injury that actually robbed him of his pace. And I don't think it's actually in the book. You mentioned that you didn't have, I think the word you used was rapid. You didn't have the same rapid speed that you'd had before the injury. Well, you're still only a kid. So you're saying from a very young age as a professional, you had to change your game.
Yeah. When I was younger, I could outpace centre-halves. I could get down the channels. I was quick and I could get there as well. And when I broke my leg, initially I had months where it never felt comfortable. I was always in, not pain, but it just felt strange. And I never felt I had the same explosion again. And I did beef up a little bit as well. But then I had to adjust my game a little bit and I became more of a target type striker. But I could still, like West Brom, I could still cover ground. I could still get into channels. I just weren't as quick doing it. And it was summed up for me, because obviously I've clocked it and I've worked on different things, and Dave's shown me different things and Cyril's shown me things. But Danny Thomas, we did, this would be about 6 years ago, something like that. Danny's over from America and we're at Coventry City watching the game with Stuart Linnell. And we're doing the interview before the game and we're talking about the good old days at Coventry. And Stuart Linnell says about the England cap. And I said, well, to be honest, Stuart, there's some great players at the time. And I don't begrudge the fact Lineker and all them played, you know, it happens, doesn't it? I can live with that. And Danny said, I thought about it later, and it was spot on. He said to me, I played against Gordon McQueen. I think it was about, say, my 8th or 10th game. Gordon McQueen's a Scotland international. I tore him to pieces. Coventry beat United 4-3. Unbelievable game at Highfield Road. But that game, the Coventry fans see this kid's arrived, and this kid's quick, strong, scores goals, everything like. He says, Danny said, I saw that game against Gordon McQueen. I was in the stand and watched that game, and you looked like you were going to go on, play for your country. You were going to go leave Coventry. The world was your oyster. You broke your leg and you maybe lost 5% of that when you came back. You were a good Premier League player or league Division One player, as it were, at the time, but you wasn't quite international class anymore. He said, but when you were, that before the Gordon McQueen game, that showed the world of possibilities ahead for you. And like, I thought about it after when he said it, and I thought maybe he's probably right. And maybe subconsciously, I did think what people were saying. Yeah, I'm going to have to adjust my game a little bit because I couldn't quite get to certain, I couldn't quite outpace certain people and that. I mean, I played against Colin Todd, who was very quick. When I come back from the injury, I could beat him in a race or beat people in a race, but all of a sudden, it's an effort to get there. I've got to go there a bit quicker. I've got to be smarter in what I do. And I just did think about the game then. I started thinking, right, I'm going to have to find different solutions because everything ain't pace and power. I'm slow to the party. People tell me things like I won't listen at times, or I listen, but I don't take it in. Dave's telling me, Cyril's telling me, people are telling me. Eventually, the penny drops and, yeah, okay, I'm going to have to do this. Playing games and not getting joy against certain people, I do have to learn a lesson. And yeah, the penny does drop with me. I mean, they tell me stuff and the penny drops and I end up getting a decent-ish career out of it, 20 years. So, like, yeah.
Still to come on When Shorts Were Short.
There were a lot of players in there who were basically there for a good time and all that. And it just didn't gel as a club, didn't seem like a proper football club. And like Graham walked in, basically ripped the whole thing apart, slaughtered everybody, got rid of a load of people, then we started getting our club back.
Half time. Thank you, those of you going to the trouble of rating, reviewing and subscribing to the podcast on your chosen podcast platform. Ultimately, that is what will keep When Shorts Were Short going. More good reviews, if you enjoy the show, increases our visibility on the various platforms and engages new listeners. That's the only way for any show to grow. Thank you too to those of you sharing links on social media, retweeting and even spreading the show word of mouth to pals who may be into their historical football. That all helps massively. When I relaunched the podcast a month before Christmas, I had to go down the route of paying for Twitter Premium, which I was reluctant to do, but I felt that it was necessary given that the show had been dormant for almost a couple of years, and I needed to find a way of getting a big visibility for the show posts and on Twitter, stroke X, whatever you call it. It has been very effective in terms of how visible those posts are, which is good to see because it is costing. But while the show is growing in terms of downloads up to around 1,100 a month, still about 900 short of where it needs to be to monetize, I don't think that growth has been down to Twitter. Therefore, I'm wondering why I'm still paying for Twitter. I'm not convinced that Twitter Premium is the right route for the show. I mean, 1,600 views, say, on a post isn't leading to more than 100 downloads a day. So if it is playing a part in those downloads, it's not very effective, is it? And that's on a decent day. And I need money coming into the show rather than going out. So I think what I'm going to do when that Twitter Premium is renewed, I think at the end of the first week of April, I'm going to delete that, which will mean the chances are that you don't see the show on your timeline so easily. So just remember, it will still be there. It will just not have the visibility that it's had on Twitter for a few months. Download the show as normal, share the links, and maybe I can keep this ambitious audio ship afloat. There are lots of historical football accounts out there who aren't verified, but they've been just tweeting for so many years now that they've accrued 60 or 70,000 followers, and they do so without a tick, which is quite commendable. But I think the days of that being able to happen for any show without going down the Twitter Premium route, I think are long gone. So I need to work out how I do this going forward. It was worth trying out, but I'm not sure it's that effective. Meantime, last week's episode on Alf Ramsey's Ipswich years did really well and got a great response. David Bowler really knows his football history, and much of that Ipswich stuff, most of it really, was new to me. Is that Ipswich 62 title success the greatest story in English football? I asked at the end of last week's episode. Graham on Twitter, I think his handle is GRA67NFFC, so I think he's a Forest fan. I might be biased, says Graham, but I think Nottingham Forest, the Brian Clough years as English football's greatest ever story. That doesn't undermine Alf Ramsey's achievements at Ipswich, which perhaps due to what he went on to do with England, doesn't tend to get the recognition it deserves. My old colleague Lee emailed. You'll have to forgive the voice there. I do have a cold. I'm so run down. I'm doing crazy hours at the minute, and I'm sure that's why I'm run down. Let me get the voice working. My old colleague Lee, he emailed, and I still need to email him back. I mentioned Lee on last week's show. He believes Ipswich were the greatest because they had to overcome Bill Nicholson's 61 double winners. I think Spurs This is me now. I think Spurs finished third in 62. I'm pretty sure they did. Burnley, the 1960 champions, finished second to Ipswich. Everton finished fourth in 62. Everton were the champions the following season. So I think that further builds the case for Ipswich. They were up against the two most recent champions and up against the team that would succeed them as champions. That really is something. Dave Bowler himself made the astute observation on Twitter during the week that perhaps Nicholson had destabilised Spurs, I'm paraphrasing here, by bringing in Jimmy Greaves during the 61-62 season. And I don't think this show would have anyone listening that would disagree, probably, that Greaves was the best striker English football has ever seen. But I think Dave is onto something here, more than onto it, really, because more recent examples of a brilliant side perhaps losing something with the arrival of such a ruthless but individualistic striker. Everton with Lineker in 85-86, we've heard about that on several episodes over the years on when shorts were short. Ian Wright arriving at Arsenal in 91 and more. Recent example, Arsenal in 91, then England's top club. They were the side that knocked Liverpool off their perch, and we discussed that with Alan Smith earlier in this series. Arsenal only won the title again 7 years later, by which time Ian Wright was winding down his career with Arsenal. Of course, that period is out of the show's purview, but I'm referring to it to give this example. Ian Wright had lost his place to a young Nicholas Anelka midway through that season, and Tony Adams later made the observation that Arsenal were only able to win the title once Wright, as outstanding as he was out of the team, because Arsenal, like Everton, had become a more direct team with the arrival of Ian Wright, and in Everton's case with Gary Lineker. I forgot to say, by the way, last week that Dave will be back in a classic kits mini-sode in which he chooses his three favourite kits from the 1954-92 window, and three very interesting kits from Dave that will be with you in the near future. Any more thoughts on this or any other 1954-92 matter, email me shortswereshort@1607westegg.com, or you can tweet the show at shortswereshort, or you can even join the Facebook group, which is growing, and I'll give that out at the end of the show. Meantime, let's get back to the second half and Gary Thompson. Before we come to your move to West Brom, listener Greg K14 says, Coventry were one of the more innovative clubs around at that time. Highfield Road became the country's first all-seater stadium, but did that impact on the atmosphere there?
Yeah, Coventry fans are quite, when the team's going well, they're quite raucous and they make a lot of noise, and they let you know as well when it's not going too well. Initially, when we had the all-seater stadium, I can't remember what team came down to play Coventry and they ripped all the seats off and it became a mess. But people felt inhibited sitting there and instead of standing together and making noise. So yes, initially we did think it was like a morgue at times. But it did get better. But initially when Jimmy was brilliant, like you say, some of his ideas, he had the chocolate brown kit, which when I first played in it, I absolutely did. Me and Danny Thomas, we went to play Leicester and it was a away game. And as we walked in the dressing room, see the kits hanging up, and I was like, "Don't I can't wear that." And instead of Dave Sixon, "No, I ain't wearing that." "What do you mean you're not wearing it?" And Dave couldn't see what we were getting at. And I went, "It's a night game. We're both black. We're going to run out of the pitch on that." And he went, what's your problem?" Dave could not see it at all. Anyway, we go out on the pitch, and as you can imagine, it's all loud as the players go out on the pitch. Then all of a sudden, take your tracksuit top off, and everything goes quiet, and all you can hear is, "Oh, I can see some eyes. I can see a pair of teeth." And like, yeah, dear God. But once you get into the game, it's done. But I hated that kit for years. And now Coventry fans talk about it. It's an iconic kit. And I have grown to like it. But the time to wear it as a black man running around with a Grace Jones haircut, at the time, it wasn't really the look.
Around this time, there is quite a bit of interest in you. There's Arsenal. Arsenal are in for you. There's Birmingham, Leeds, I think, who just dropped into the old second division. Towards the end of the 82-83 season, you reluctantly join West Brom, where Ron Wiley is now manager. Why the reluctance on your part to make the move initially?
Well, the year before, Arsenal came in for me, Leeds came in for me, Brighton, who were a Premier League side at the time, Division One side, they came in for me. There were lots of interest in me. Coventry decided they weren't going to let me go and they were going to give me a new contract. So my wife had just had a baby. Well, we just lost the baby. So I'm like, I'm quite happy to stay at Coventry. I could see this team, potentially we could do stuff. So I'm in no rush to go anywhere. So happy to stay. Within a year, Coventry lose a load of money in America. I think we bring a kid called Dave Bradford over from not Cosmos, but what Jimmy Hill's team, Detroit Express. We bring him over as a payment. Coventry have got no money. They've lost an awful lot of money. And then one day, I'd lost a bit of form. I was getting back in the team because David broke my game down. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to feel the results of it. And the wife's pregnant. We go shopping for the day, come back to the house. The phone rings. There's no mobile phone. So the phone rings about 9 o'clock. I pick the phone up. And it's the chairman. Where the f*** have you been? I said, well, Mr. Chairman, I've been out for the day with my wife. We've had a bit of food. It's been lovely. So I'm on that sarcastic tone. He said, listen, get yourself down to the Albion. Ron's agreed a deal to buy you. We've agreed everything's sorted. Get yourself down there in the morning. Be there for 9:30. All the best. And I went, oh, hang on a minute. Well, how much are you selling me for? He went, it's nothing to do with you. I said, well, I don't want to go. I'm quite happy to stay anyway. No, no, you're going. And he said, we're going to go bankrupt in 6 weeks. So unless you go, we're done for. You have to go. Put the phone down. Talked it over with my wife. Women are more sensible about stuff like that. I'm like, I ain't going anywhere. He could have sold me for a lot of money. Now it suits him. He wants to sell me. No, I'm not going anywhere. I'm happy. We've got just had the bab. I'm going to stay here. Like, anyway, she's go and have a chat with him. You never know. Ron likes you. So anyway, I go to have the chat. But I'm reluctant to go there because Ali Robertson and John Wall used to boot me all over the gaff when I played against the Albion on a regular basis. I mean, it wasn't Benham, but they give me plenty. And then when they got bored, Martin Bennett came off the bench and he gave me a kick in as well. So like, you can understand my reluctance to go and join a club where they seem to hate me. So I don't want to go there. But in the end, I go for the conversation. They show me around the ground. A lot of the players are training at different training grounds, so I don't really see many people. They give me a medical. I'm going through all this with no intention of signing. I'm just listening to what they're going to say. They basically offer me more or less the same on what I'm getting, but 25 grand signing on fee, which is great, but you know, it's not brilliant. It's not, like, they're going to change my life. So yeah, you know, I'm quite happy. So I say, Coventry owe me £10,000. So this is my, Ron, you can imagine Ron bullies me. So like, Ron's going, right then, we'll get the contract signed up, get it signed. I was suspended, shock, the following Saturday. So he says, if you sign now, you can do your suspension on Saturday. You're available to play the following week. And I went, oh, the only thing is, like, Coventry owe me £10,000. If I leave, I've lost £10,000. I've got a baby. I can't give up £10,000. And he went, right. 10 minutes later, the phone rings. Jimmy Hill's on the phone. Chairman, what's the word here? Hello, Mr. Hill. Gary, what's something about £10,000? Yep. £10,000. He said, well, think about it. 40p in the pound tax is £6,000. So what we're talking about is £6,000. He says £6,000 a couple more times. £6,000. He says, now, I've seen the pictures of you and Tommy English in them stupid rude boy outfits and that. So you're going to buy yourself a bit of gear. Your missus is pregnant. You're going to buy some baby stuff and all that. Probably get yourself a car, like, because you have to pose and all that. He says, by the time you've done it all in, you're talking about £2,000. How's £2,000 sound? And I went, sounds like £2,000. Don't sound like what I'm going to sign for. And he went, look, we'll work something out. Ron comes back, and I can't remember. I think they offered me another £1,000 on top or something. And Ron put the contract down in front of me, and Ron went, pardon my language, sign it, you've got 10 minutes. And I went, you can't just bully people into doing things like that. Went out, closed the door. Secretary went, do you want a cup of tea? I went, no, and I'm not signing it. I sat there, 9 minutes gone. I'm like, ah, you can go f*** yourself, no chance. 8 minutes. Who's he think he is trying to try and bully me into signing? I'm fucking, I will not be dictated to like that. 6 minutes on sign. And that was it. Next day, I drive into the Albion. Then I panic because I've got to meet these players who have kicked the lumps out of me. I drive around the training, the ground 3 times before I finally go in. I walk in the dressing room. I see Dave Matthews, God rest his soul. So I'm the next Gary Thompson, new signing. Where do I go? Go in there. You're number one. I walk in. Number one used to belong to a kid called David Mills, who they bought for Middlesbrough, who they bought for £500,000. Apparently, everything that went wrong for David Mills. So no one had that number. I don't know this. So I walk in. I walk in, take my jacket off, going to hang my jacket off, and there's a banana hanging over the peg. So I knock the banana off. I'm like, nice one, good start. Derek Statham sidles up to me. He says, big man, that's John Wall, you know, don't like the brothers. He's not having the brothers at all. And I'm like, I've walked into this. What have I done? So John Wall was with us for 3 weeks after that before he went to be a player coach at Peterborough. And every day in training for the 3 weeks, I proceeded to try and boot him all over the place. Then 20 years later, I'm at a dinner, Albion, it's a game, corporate game. Albion beat Chelsea 4-0 the day Chelsea take the title at the Hawthorns. I'm sitting at a table with John Wall, my current wife, and Ali Robertson, a couple of others. Story comes up, and Ali Robertson says, you know that was Statham, don't you? And I went, I've been booting John Wall forever. I've been hating John Wall for 20 years over this. So then I proceed to explain to John Wall why I've carried all this angst for him. He was good as gold, John. He could eat monkeys like. But that's the reason I didn't want to go to the Albion, because I didn't think they liked me. They played a prank on me when I first got there. So anything I'd said or got involved in, they just sort of, yeah, right. And so the first week or so was murder.
I remember reading that bit about your first day at West Brom, until you did the reveal that John Wiley hadn't actually been involved in that. I thought, really, John Wiley? Because that's such a, you know, that club did more than most clubs to bring football in this country into that multicultural age. And that would have been really disappointing. So unfortunately for John Wiley, it took 20 years for you to learn the truth. West Brom at this point, let's just look at where they were, because I think that they'd lost Ron Atkinson in 81. He's taken Remy Moses and Brian Robson with him. It's Brendan Batson, I think, is about to retire. You make a good observation about Cyril Regis in Don't Believe a Word. You say that, I mean, he wasn't the Cyril Regis that we'd known in those first 4 or 5 years at West Brom. I think there was a story that came out a few years ago that when Van Basten was sold by Ajax to Milan, that Johan Cruyff walked out of Ajax because the player he wanted to replace him was Cyril Regis. And some people were surprised by that. But if you look at Cyril Regis in those early West Brom years, it wouldn't surprise you, because he was a hell of a player. But by the time that you arrived there, maybe it's not quite happening for Cyril Regis. Was it a team in transition, basically?
Yeah, I mean, when I looked at the squad, the likes of McKenzie, Gary Owen, Derek Statham, obviously Cyril, Nicky Cross, who is very underrated, very good player, Tony Morley comes to the club. When you look at that squad, Stevie Hunt was there as well, because Steve followed me to every club I played at. I mean, like, people say, I mean, Steve was a fantastic footballer and one of the best footballers. When I put teams down, Steve Hunt is always a top man in my team, but I've got to be honest, I think he just followed me around because he just liked to play with me, like, you know. I mean, when I speak to him, I'm going to tease him about it. But yeah, we had a great squad. Paul Barron was a goalkeeper, Tony Godden. We had a good squad. We underperformed, but it was a team in transition. We did throw Noel Luke and Mickey Perry and young kids in there as well. We never quite did what we should have done. But you look at all them players, they were names. And on our day, we were a different class. We beat Nottingham Forest 4-1, I think, one day. And they were one of the top teams at the time. When Cluffy signs the ball for me and my nephew, my son, actually ruined the ball. But stuff like that, on our day, we were a different class. We would have it off. We were a quality team, good footballers. And it was a pleasure to play in that side. So, yeah, we just underperformed. We should have done an awful lot better with the players we had, even losing Robson and Moses and people like that. Because Martin Jol came. Martin Jol and Romeo Zondervan. You're looking at, like, Martin Jol is the filthiest man alive. In training, he will boot you just for the sake of booting you. Romeo's on about skillful, tricky, bright, got a goal in him as well. Like, so you had good midfield players there as well. Like, even to this day, when you talk about that team, I can't understand how we never did anything. That team was tailor-made, built to crack on and do something.
Johnny Giles arrives a year on from your turning up at the Hawthorns, and, you know, within about 7 or 8 months, he's moved on Cyril Regis to Coventry. And it's clear from the beginning that Johnny Giles perhaps doesn't fancy you as a player, or there is some issue there. How quickly did you become aware that you might need to move on?
Probably the first week. Johnny turns up as a manager. We're all in awe. Because Johnny Giles of Leeds United has come to our football club, and he'd been manager at the Albion before, and he'd been there when he got a promotion. But John was a player coach then, player manager. And so Johnny Giles walks in and he's got that aura about him. So when John starts talking and he's on the training pitch, and he says the first thing he says is, right, I'm going to show you a free kick, a corner, say two free kicks in a corner, and I'll show you each one three times. If you can't grasp it, you shouldn't be here. So you can imagine kids' brains like me and Nicky Cross, who are just complete idiots. Well, oh my Lord, oh my God. So we start panicking, and then Johnny shows us bits and bobs. But all through it all, I just got the impression he wanted a different type of striker. I mean, when I first got there, it was me and Cyril playing together. The week before, we played Nottingham Forest and we got beat 3-0 or something like that. I got smashed in. I had a diving header, went to head the ball. Viv Anderson smashed me in the boat, and I lose few hours of my life. I wake up, I've got like stitches in my mouth. My wife's at the hospital trying to keep me awake. The doctor says to me, right, you can't play Saturday, son, because you need plastic surgery. Ron Wiley gets a sack on the Thursday. I don't play on the Saturday. Johnny Giles turns up on the Sunday, managing, I text the team on the Monday. he's talking to the lads, and obviously I'm not playing or signing, or I'm walking around the training pitch, and he says, big man, come walk with me. So I go and walk with him. And he says, seen you play, heard a lot about you. You're a big game lad, ain't you? And I said, well, you know, I have a go. And he says, yeah, he says, do you remember a guy called Mick Jones? So I'm like, hold up, Mick Jones, cool, big centre forward, played for Sheffield United, played for Leeds. Mick Jones broke his collarbone in the cup final, diving header. Mick Jones, proper centre forward, like. And he went, yeah, yeah, he's a good player, Mick, wasn't he? And walked off. And so I went, oh. So I told the lads the story, and Cyril and all them went, he's not having you at all. And then he'd always, not pick on me, but he'd have a go at me about certain things. Get hold of the ball, get hold of the ball. They used to have a sweepstake on the bench. How long before he slags off Tomo or Crossy about controlling the ball or getting hold of it? And he used to use about 3 minutes. Get hold of it, you lot! And so there was always the thing, but people thought I was going to slag off Johnny in the book and that, but I scored more. I was more consistent goal scoring wise than him. I played better football at times, but he got most out of me. Maybe I was scared to death of him, but he got a lot out of me. And when I see John now, it's like we get on really well. We got on well at the time. Just as a manager, he was demanding. He wanted the best from me. I understood that because he played in the Leeds United side, and none of us were ever going to match up to the likes of Bremner, Mickey Jones, Alan Clark, and all that. So he's always going to demand more. So yeah. Never had a problem with John. I don't think I was his type of striker. I don't think Cyril was his type of striker. But things happen. I never felt he was personal. I just felt he demanded an awful lot. I've always had demanding coaches, so he never bothered me. Other players would get up, you know, go under a little bit. Never bothered me because I scored goals. So he got what he wanted. I got what I wanted.
You had a good 84-85 season. You got 21 goals for West Brom that season. So it is strange that the club was so keen to move you on. And they try selling you to Servette in Switzerland, which I find really odd. But there's a twist to that as well. All wasn't what it seems. You do come close to joining, but it doesn't happen. But it's just it's a really strange tale. Just give our listeners a little bit on that.
Right. I scored 21 goals. And like, I'm now, in my opinion, me and Nicky Cross, we're the two lowest paid players at the club. Because obviously other people have come in. They're on a lot more money. Cyril's gone. And Cyril, the rumour was Cyril and Statham were getting £2,000 a week. I'm getting £450 a week with a £100 appearance. So I don't expect to be the top paid player at the club, but I want to be brought into line. I've got a baby and all that. And a missus who doesn't spend money like this one, like he's going out of fashion, but spends money. I want some respect, some appreciation. So like, I make an appointment to see the gaffer. So I go and see Johnny Giles. And as it happens on the day, the wife drops me off. She's going to go shopping. She drops me to the ground. But I stop at newspaper shop, get a paper, back of the paper, Arsenal in for Thompson, £400,000. Happy days. Put it under my arm, walk in. So I'm waiting for John when he comes into the office. They bring us a cup of tea. So I open the paper. So all Johnny Giles sees when he comes into the office is the picture of me and £400,000 Thompson and all that. And he goes, you can put that down. So I put it down. He says, so what do you want? So I went, well, to be fair, you know, I've been top scorer from the moment I walked into the club. I'm the second lowest paid player. I want to be brought more into line. I don't expect to be the top paid player, but I want to be brought into line with the others. His response, how do you fancy Switzerland? I'm like, you are. He says, get yourself up to Switzerland. There's an agent called Tommy Lawrence. Get yourself up to Potter's Bar. They'll take you over there, meet the club. There's fantastic money in it. Big man, get yourself over there. It's well worth looking at. I don't want to go. Get yourself over there. So in the end, he said, take the missus and Bab. So me and my missus and Bab have gone for essentially a 4-day, 5-day holiday. So we've got up to London, the Potter's Bar, flew over to Servette. They've shown us the ground. They've shown us where we're going to stay. It's an apartment that's like, probably I'll say as big as my house at the time. And like, they promise us cars. They give it off us what works out to about $114,000 a year, tax-free, flights home. Anything you wanted was laid on. And I kept asking him, well, what about that then? Oh, yeah, you can have that. What about this then? Yeah, you can have that. So I'm saying to Louise, my wife at the time, I'm saying, Lou, I don't want to come here, but this will protect my family and sort my family out. And she's going, look, it's your career, but you've got to think about what's best. We could all survive, you know, well after football with this. So in the end, it looks like I'm going to have to sign. So more or less verbally agreed to sign and that. Then on the evening, we have a big dinner. So we have the dinner. The next day, there's a press conference. It's all going to be done and dusted. So at the dinner, I can see the waiter and he keeps looking over at me. Now, my mom, typical West Indian woman, wherever I'm in the world, she will find me. So when this fella keeps looking over, I think it's her. So he comes over, he says, Mr. Thompson, he says, phone call. So I walk over, pick the phone up, hey, you found me, didn't you? And it was Sid Lucas, the Albion chairman. And he says, big man, I've just found out what's happening. I says, what do you mean, Mr. Lucas? He said, and these words were, those robbing bastards, blah, blah, blah. They've tried to pull the wool over our eyes. He said, I've just found out that Fiorentina put the money up. You're going to go to Servette for a year, then you're going to Fiorentina. And I went, then what's the problem with that? Because all of a sudden, Italy, everyone played in Italy at the time. It was a place to be. So I'm like, what's the problem with that? He said, well, I'm not having it. They've agreed, I think the fee was 500 grand or something. He's never agreed 500 grand. He said, I've asked for some more money. I said, you've agreed a deal. You can't turn around and change the deal. No, I've asked another 50 grand. So I went, my last words to Sid Lucas, God rest his soul, was, I'll give you the 50 grand out of my own pocket as the phone goes down. I'm never going to give it you, by the way. And go back to the table. Louise says to me, what's up? I said, I'll tell you later. So I tell her what's going on. She says, see what happens in the morning. Get down in the morning. It's all kerfuffle. The press conference has been cancelled. They put me back on the plane, but they say to me, look, we'll get this deal done. So I'll come back to the Albion. Not a problem. I'll come back to England, rather. Next day, I go to the Albion training. I drive into the training ground. Johnny Giles comes flying out of the dressing rooms and that. Big man, off. Hello, Gaffer. Nice to see you. No. He says, the press knows something's up. Clear off. I said, what do you mean clear off? It's pre-season. I've got to do some training. He went, no, get off. They know something's up. Now, I don't know, but they've signed Crooks and Berardi with the money they were going to get for me. So all of a sudden, Albion being, you know, that really generous club that don't spend the penny, someone's got to go. So like, I'll get back home and I think, well, I know what I'll do, I'll train. So like, I get my kit on, I start running. Anyone will tell you, a bit like Cyril, I can run for about half a mile, then I'm in trouble. So like, I ran for, I'd say a mile. I did some change, I phoned the wife, she had to come and pick me up, bring me back. I was an athlete, by the way. I get back and I'm like, I'm never doing that again. But I had to train on my own, so I know I've got to do stuff with that. So I'm trying to do bits and bobs. Then all of a sudden, Sid Lucas says, he rings up, Giles, he rings, oh, you've got to go have talks with Sheffield Wednesday. I had a conversation with Aston Villa, QPR coming for me, the Arsenal coming for me, but they all dropped out of the bidding. And it was Sheffield Wednesday in the end and Chelsea. So I've gone up to Sheffield. I've gone and spent the day and a half there with Howard and all that. And I knew Howard from the under-21s. But he was a doer. He was quiet, but he was a doer. So I'm thinking, well, I couldn't see what they're all about. But I've got no intention of signing for Sheffield. If you drive into Sheffield, I think it's Junction 28. As you drive in, all you can see is these chimney pots with all smoke coming out. So I remember driving in, I pull over, my missus, I looked at her, I went, look round, this is where we could be for the next couple of years. I'm telling you, we ain't doing it. So we go in anyway, have a conversation with her. I'm not going to sign. They take her house hunting and shopping. And they take her all the beautiful places, Sheffield. And Sheffield's a beautiful place. I'm talking with these people. The agents, Tommy Lawrence, have come on the deal now. And I'm like, I ain't paying you. And they said, no, we'll get sorted out. Don't worry. So they say they're negotiating the deal. The negotiation goes on for the best part of 2 or 3 hours. I've got my boy with me. Now, my boy, Ben, he's about 3 then, but he's always got a ball. So, like, conversation gets, this discussion goes on. And I get bored talking about money. So I'm like, where's my lad? He's gone. So I'm running. Wait, have you ever seen me boy? He's out on the pitch with Howard Wilkinson. And I look, I'm up the tunnel. I look at the pitch. Howard Wilkinson, he's with my son, showing my son how to celebrate when you smack a ball into the goal. And I look at it and think, he can't be too bad then. Because I didn't know Howard. Because obviously, with the under-21s, Dave Sexton and Terry Venables were the two main coaches. And Howard would do all the bits and bobs, but Howard was quieter. So I don't really know how he is. So I joined. In the end, I come back. I have a chat with Chelsea. Basically, Ken Bates wants me to sign what turns out could be a blank contract. But as he walked in the room, the things he said to me and the wife, there was no way I was signing for Chelsea either. So I'm saddled with two clubs I don't particularly want to sign for. But one of them has shown my boy a level of understanding and love that I think, he's a decent geezer. So I signed for Sheffield Wednesday. Obviously, they weigh me in. I get paid good money. The disappointing thing was I never scored the goals there. I mean, I get good response from Sheffield Wednesday people because I worked hard and had a go and we did well there, but I work hard anyway. Any footballer should work hard anyway. So I'd say, well, that's a prerequisite. But I didn't score the goal, so I never felt I really made it there. And then when Howard gave me the opportunity to go to Villa, the way he put the conversation, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go. I'll go and sign for the Villa. But really, in a way, I should have stayed at Sheffield Wednesday a bit longer. But then you don't get a chance to play for your boy or club too many times. So
was it that you wanted to feel a bit more wanted by Wilkinson, even though it was your boyhood club coming in for you? You weren't happy about the manner of your departure.
He rings me from Mexico because he's working for the BBC covering the 86 World Cup. I think it's not long after Maradona scores the wonder goal against England. Brings me. Now, Howard's quite blunt anyway. Like, so now then, hello, Gaffer. He said, we've got an offer for Aston Villa. He says, they want to sign you. He says, you can go or you can stay. It's up to you. That was it. I went, oh, okay then. So I put the phone down. I'm like, well, I'm going to go and talk to him anyway, like, because they'd agreed a fee. But if he'd have said, look, it didn't work out, big man, as well we thought last year, but we did ever so well as a group. We can get more out of you, blah, blah, blah. I would have been caught with, I would have been torn. And because my own ego, I didn't want to leave Sheffield Wednesday the way it was, because I didn't feel like I achieved there. I didn't feel that I did well enough there. So I didn't want to walk away knowing I hadn't done it. But the boyhood club had come in for me. And also, he never really made me feel like he was that bothered. Did he? And I'm like, I'm going to sign. Which is probably one of the worst things I ever did. So, like, I signed for Aston Villa. And it went rapidly downhill from there.
Could you see that coming, the problems with Villa in 86, 87? Did you look around the dressing room and think we might be in trouble here?
You know, initially, I went because it's Aston Villa. I'm back home in Birmingham, house hunting. We're doing this and that. I do my first couple of days training. My dad's a big Villa fan. My family are big Villa fans. So my dad, on the Sunday, every other Sunday, I always went to my mum and dad's for dinner, which usually coincided with me being sent off. And usually my dad would close the door in my face. But, you know, on the odd occasion, everything was sweet. I'd go around there. And he says, right then, what's it like then? And he wants to know all the ins and outs, all nitty-gritty. And I went, I've done about 10 days training. And they've got me in a hotel, Holiday Inn, me and the missus and that, because we've got actually Sheffield, so we're living in the hotel. And I went, well, Dad, it's not like how you think it is. Goes, what do you mean? Get your head in the game. What's the matter with you? Sheffield Wednesday's done now. You're playing Aston Villa. Get on with it. This is what you wanted to do. But I'm trying to say, it's not quite how I envisaged it. As a player, I was always interested in football and facts and what's going on. I never looked at Aston Villa's record over the 2 years previous. They'd won the European Cup about 4 years before and the Super Cup and all that. And I never looked at how they'd done. What they'd done is got rid of a load of experience. Mortimer, with and Shaw was injured. And a lot of them had gone, Karens and that. And they brought a load of kids through. They got to the semi-final of the League Cup, which Matt covered a multitude of sins, but they got beat. And so by the time I'm training with these kids, they bought Keown, Cooper and myself. And they bought a spine and they're going to try and put the framework around it. Hunty was there, obviously. But it was, I trained and it just weren't right. And the stuff we did at Sheffield Wednesday, where Howard would break it down, where you do defence work, midfield work, attack work, and it all comes together, a bit like they do nowadays. So Howard is well ahead of his time. I'm watching that and I used to moan during it. And now I'm thinking, why don't we do any of that? And I just thought it was just sloppy. The whole thing was just not set up right. And I remember talking with Hunty about it and Gary Shaw. Because they're like the Villa fans anyway. Like, I'm saying, this just ain't right. This don't feel right. And it just felt like there were a lot of players in there who were basically there for a good time and all that. And it just didn't gel as a club. Didn't seem like a proper football club. And like Graham walked in, basically ripped the whole thing apart, slaughtered everybody, got rid of a load of people. Then we started getting our club back. The first few months was difficult. And then I got an injury, which I persisted in playing on with, which got worse and worse. And in the end, I'm out for 11 months. We get relegated. So you can imagine as a local lad, the abuse my old man was taking at work, but then obviously he's giving it me. Everywhere I go, I was getting it. So it was a bad, bad time, horrible time, but it makes you stronger, doesn't it? You have to cope.
So this is Graham Turner and Billy McNeil have both gone during the 86-87 season. You're now in the second division. And as you say, Graham Taylor comes in. Was it clear to you from 87 when Graham Taylor did walk in that Villa were in good hands, even if certain players didn't buy into Graham Taylor's methods and the style of football? Was it clear that the club were going to be going in the right direction under Graham Taylor?
Definitely. Graham Taylor walks into the club. Now, as I say, I played against Watford in the League Cup quarterfinal and we smashed them. And I knew he liked me because of that performance. And I knew that I was his type of striker, an aggressive centre forward who covered ground and all that. So I'm thinking, like, if I can get myself fit, I've got half a chance here. He bowls in the first day. Doug opens the door and says, gentlemen, all the players are in the canteen. The new manager of Aston Villa, big grin on his face. Graham bowls in. He says, thank you, Mr. Ellis. Closes the door on your way out. Ben proceeds to say, right then, you lot will say, who's he? Where's he been? Who's he played for? I played for Grimsby and Scunthorpe. My career ended at 28 through an injury, blah, blah, blah. Goes through his career. He says, right, then, bang. Now, let's get to you. Proceeds to start slaughtering people. And I'm sure I'm around Hunty and Shorey and all that, because I'm around the Villa contingent and I'm nudging, he's letting them have it. and he's getting right into him. Dorigo, have you done your best for this football club the last year? Yes, yeah. Well, how come you've had a move lined up to Chelsea since Christmas? Oh, and he's, and then Paul Elliott, he starts slagging people off, but he knows all the answers. And we're giggling in the corner, like, he's letting them have it. And he was like a whirlwind. He walked in, slammed people, let them know we weren't going to tolerate it. My first three meetings, this is the first meeting with Graham Taylor. Towards the end of that conversation, he goes, and you, doesn't even look at me, and goes, big centre forward, been bought for 400 grand, don't score no goals. In fact, gets more bookings than goals, runs around with your socks down, seems to be arguing with everybody, like, what do you do? You're injured now, you're no good to me. In fact, you might as well just now. And I was like, yeah, all right. No. Get out. So I'm like, all right. So I go out, but I meet the lads in the car park and I'm like, he's going to tear this place apart. And we, the local lads, we're delighted. My next meeting with Graham, I pull up in the, I go to training, pull up into the car park. Warren Aspinall is standing there and he's talking to Graham Taylor. Warren Aspinall is now walking back to his car. Graham Taylor's standing there, suited and booted with Steve Harrison, Bobby Downs. Warren Aspinall's walking back to his car, get out of my car. And Warren looks a bit like George Formby because of the teeth. So I'm like, Forms, what's happening? And he goes, good luck, gets in the car, drives off. So I know there's trouble afoot. So if you imagine, behind them is the training ground, the canteen, everything. My right-hand side is the pitches. So I walk out to the pitches. I do the old golfer's one, pick a bit of grass up, see which way the wind's blowing, try and work my way around the back of him. As I get to the door, he waits till I get open the door. He says, can I ask you a question? Yep. Where do you live? Bassett's Pole, about 5 minutes from here, Kaffer. Bassett's Pole, what, describe your house. That's five-bedroomed. Detached, obviously got foundations to go out for swimming pool, got a study, got a bar, got this, got that, sauna and all that. He says, oh, I bet it's lovely, isn't it? Says, yeah, it's really nice. He says, what do you think your neighbours think when they see you in the mornings? I said, oh, I think there's Tomo going to training. He goes, no, he says, they say, look at that scruffy git. He said other words as well, but he said, look at that scruffy git. He says, you actually, that's your place of work. You're going to go training. No, you're going to go to your place of work. He said, look at you. He said, look at the way you're dressed. By the way, I was wearing a black leather jacket, white T-shirt, blue jeans, no socks and white trainers, which were pristine. And he went, you look like the Black Fonz. He says, f*** off, home. If you come back to training, come back dressed properly. So basically, if you're coming to training, slacks and a shirt or a tracksuit, you are going to work. Now, f*** off, home. Okay, got it. From tomorrow. No, now. So I've gone home, got back in my house. Missus is like, what's happened? I told her, she off laughing. I've come back. From that day, he gave us three sets of kits. We stayed in a hotel, home and away. So he got us to know each other and spend time with each other again. He made us go out into the city and do functions and do all sorts with the fans. He made us train at Villa Park at every opportunity so we could get a connection back with the ground because everybody hated us because we just got Villa relegated. He knew all the answers and he really got us going again. He was perfect for us. I mean, I knew, obviously, me and Graham butted heads a lot of times. And if I'd have been injured, if I'd have been fit at the time, he'd have sold me. But because I was injured, then I got fit and got in the team, scored goals. We sort of tolerated each other and got on. But yeah, the first two meetings were horrendous. The third one, he was asking me what was wrong with the club, in my opinion. He interviewed everybody. I told him about the medical side, what had gone wrong. He ends the conversation saying that, oh, yeah, he says, I had your brother, England youth player. He said, England youth. He said, good lad, good left foot, good ability, beats people, it gets crosses in, scores goals. He said, he's a fantastic kid. And he's waxing about your brother. I went, yeah, he's not bad, Keith, is he? And he goes, yeah, yeah, he's a lovely lad. You know, leader in the dressing room, he's a good lad. You, on the other hand, and never said a word. It must be like 20 seconds, never said anything. I went, is that it then? And he started shuffling papers. So that was our first three meetings. And it was funny because I was telling lads, he's going to slaughter people. He's not going to stand on ceremony. You're going to know where you stand. He was like a whirlwind at the football club, but it was my club. So I was delighted that he came in and did what he did because we needed it.
It's interesting because in the book, you say that when Villa clinched promotion at the first time of asking at Swindon, you're in the dressing room afterwards and the players are celebrating, but the experience for you is slightly marred because you can see Taylor watching you all celebrating and you felt he was eyeing you all player by player, working out who he would keep for Division One, which I suppose is the kind of ruthlessness that the top managers need. Off the pitch, it's not an easy time for you. And your older brother, Ian, who I think he was about a year and a half older than you, was terminally ill. Sadly, he passes away, I think, in the summer of 88. Does that bereavement play a part
in your leaving Villa during the 88-89 season?
Yeah, I mean, 2 days before, Ian had been complaining about a bad back or pains in his back for about a year. I'd been playing, I had back hip back problems as well. So we just thought it was part of the Thompson thing. Like, then 2 days before we play Swindon, he books himself into the Priory Hospital. They're going to do an operation. They say it's gallstones. We get promoted on the Saturday. I obviously go out with the lads, have a drink, see him on the Sunday, go to the hospital. And all he says is, I'm going to have to take these tablets for the rest of my life. Doesn't say anything else about it. Now, he's like the closest person to me. There's 18 months between us, or 13 or 15 months, but we are very close. He'd ring each other. He'd ring me every day, usually poncing tickets off of me or selling bits of bobs because he's a bit of a rogue. But he's my brother. I love him to death and that. And then all of a sudden, he's struggling. Then bit by bit, we realise what's happening. It's pancreatic cancer. We lose him 3 months later. And to be fair, in a way, if I didn't have the football, the structure of going to training every day, I would have definitely gone off the rails. But by then, my marriage to my first wife is breaking up. I've got a bad injury. I don't know. I've got back in the team. I've got over my injury, but things ain't the same. I was lost. And I ended up being stupid, doing silly things. And yeah, losing Ian, it rocked me mom and dad, because you bury your parents don't bury their children. And so it rocked my family. And like when I got the chance to leave, I got a chance to go to Oxford, and I messed that one up deliberately, and Graham ripped me about it. And then I ended up going to Watford. And I remember going to Watford, Steve Harrison was there by then. I signed for Watford. I had no intention of signing. They talked me into signing, and I spent the afternoon lying on the bed crying my eyes out because I was absolutely devastated. But I know I had to get out of Birmingham. I had to go and try and do something different. But yeah, I'd been on a downward spiral. All I had was the structure of turning up to football and trying to play football. But even that wasn't enough at the time. Like, losing my brother, it knocked me for a long, long time.
Yeah, Steve Harrison, he's your old Villa coach. So he's now manager at Watford, and the club have a decent season. Watford reached the playoff semis. But I thought that this is the first time, okay, that you're based down south in your career. But I thought, given how difficult life had become for you off the pitch, I thought that this might be the wrong time for you to be living away from your family and what you knew. But you're saying, you've just said there that you felt you needed to get out of Birmingham at that particular time.
Yeah, my marriage had broken up. So and initially, me and Louise, who were childhood sweethearts, there was so much tension between us that I couldn't get to see my boy on a regular basis. So she'd let me have him for an hour, and it used to kill me. So when I went away, I'd come back on my day off. I'd come back the weekend after the football on a Saturday. I'd get him on a Saturday night and have him on a Sunday. So that was me solace. And I needed to get away to get a clearer picture. But when I went to Watford, I knew it wasn't the right thing for me. But I knew I needed to get out of Birmingham. There was too much pain in Birmingham. There was too much going on in Birmingham. I needed a bit of distance from it. But I just chose the wrong club. It was the wrong club at the time. Going to Watford, it never really worked out. Harry was brilliant with me. We fell out a couple of times, but Harry was brilliant. Realistically, well, looking at it now, maybe I should have stayed and just worked my way through it. But I thought, get away and get a clearer picture. Like, I got away, but because of my son, I was back in Birmingham every minute I could because I needed to spend time with my boy. He was my child. I had to see him as much as possible.
Steve Couple, you moved to Crystal Palace, I think, in 1990. Yeah. You're cup tied, so you miss out on their cup run. You're part of a very exciting young squad, the likes of Wright, Bright, Sulaco, Thomas, Andy Gray, your old Villa teammate, the second Andy Gray, he's back at Palace. You say in the book that Steve Couple gave you your love back for the game. And I think this is why you elected to stay on for another year at Palace, knowing you weren't going to be playing much. In hindsight, were you too good still at that stage of your career to be settling for being an understudy?
Yes, yeah. When I first went to Palace, my first conversation with Couple, because I thought Tony Coton was winding me up initially, but I finally get to speak to Couple. We have a chat. I say, look, first thing first, I'm cup tied. He says, I know about that. I want to sign you. We've got 8 games. I need you to play these 8 games and help keep us up. After that, if you want to go, you can go. We played the 8 games. I'm cup tied. Wrighty plays in the cup final. We end up going to, went to the Cayman Islands and Jamaica and all around the West Indies. Anyway, a couple calls me one day and we're on the, me and him, walk with me, big man, walking on the beach. Could always be two lovers. And he's like, well, what do you think then? And by now, this fella, it's made me love football again. Like, and I love the dressing room. I love the club. Palace was a loud, vibrant club, full of loud people. Like, and I just loved it. It was funny. There was stuff going on all the time. And even though I was 30, I felt really part of it and I loved it. And he just said, I said, you can go if you want. He says, but I'd like you to stay. He said, but what do you want to do? It's completely up to you. I won't take it personal anyway. And now, if I'm just looking money, Palace will give me a fair few quid to join. I'm going to get all my money in my contract and I can go to another club. And because we've stayed up, I'm going to get a club. But I just wanted to stay. So I went, yeah, I'm going to stay. Look, realistically, if I looked at it, they just brought in a kid called Colin Moore. Jamie Morley was there. Obviously, Wrighty, Brighty. They had plenty of centre forwards. The kid called David White, who played Charlton, who passed away. They had loads of centre forwards in that. And they didn't need me there. But I wanted to stay. I liked it there. And fair play to Coppell. They gave me opportunities. I come off the bench a few times, played a few games. But I lost a year of my career. In the end, after 3 or 4 months, it was festering with me because I realised time was running out and I needed to play. And as much as I loved it at Palace, it was a wrong move. I should not have stayed. I should have gone off and carried on playing.
The show's cut-off point is the early 90s. And the last of your moves that fit into this period, you reunite with Gerry Francis, your old Coventry teammate. And although this QPR side, they'd lost Paul Parker to United that summer, Gerry Francis had still inherited a very strong squad from Don Howe. And after a slow start, the club find their groove in the second half of the season. Was part of your brief there to help oversee the development of a young Les Ferdinand who was starting to come through?
Yeah, I mean, the way Gerry said it to me, he said, I've got a few centre-forwards here, he says, but none of them know how to be a proper centre-forward. I need someone to come in and actually be a proper man, proper dressing room, a leader, but a centre-forward. I want them to look at how you train and how you work. You'll play the few games, but I want them to look how you work and how you can look yourself. So I'm like, yeah, cool. I go in there, like, Ray Wilkins is the boss. Ray Wilkins is there. He's the main man. Alan McDonald's there. David Bardsley. We've got Darren Peacock. Roy Wegley, who is one of the most gifted players I ever played with. Andy Sinton, Gary Penrice, Ian Holloway. So like Jan Stasekull, the keeper. So I go into this dressing room full of experienced pros in that, and it's a good young side. And we end up finishing, we're top team in London under Gerry. We do ever so well. And I'll play a few games, but generally I'm on the bench. But the one kid, he says to me, he weren't too sure about as he's centre forward. He's a bit soft and that at times and that. And it must have been a few weeks later. I was chatting with him and Frank Sibley. And I remember saying, you know, that centre forward you're on about. He said, yeah. I said, he does everything I can do, but he does it so much better. And this is Ferdinand. Les Ferdinand. First time I'd seen him play a couple of games, but not really looked at him that much. When I watched him in training and seen him in games, this kid's frightening. Things he did, you thought, oh, my Lord. He could leave. Wally Downs. I knew Wally from Crystal Palace. Wally rang me and he went, what's it like? Because he's a big QPR fan. He said, what's it like, Bomber? I said, yeah, it's really good. I said, like, yeah, good lads and that, and the club's good and that. He said, what do you think of the boy Ferdinand? And I went, he can do everything I can do, yeah, much, much better. And he goes, that's got a burn in it. That's got to hurt you to just look at the future. That's the kid's the future. And he was only laughing and joking. But I was like, yeah, you're right. And then I realised I'm an older centre forward now. But yeah, I took great pleasure in watching him develop as a player and as a bloke. And I mean, even the way he conducts himself, he was just, he didn't need to learn from me. He carries himself, Les Ferdinand. And he always said that he had imposter syndrome. He thought that one day someone was going to come in and say, oh, sorry, son, take the kit off you. Like, no, you're not good enough for here. And apparently that drove him on all the time. But the kid I saw never looked like to me he was ever worried about anyone thinking that he wasn't a centre forward. He walked in. He carried himself like a centre forward. Like I'd probably walked in at West Brom or walked in at other clubs. He walked in like that, like he was the man. He was the daddy. And so Les Ferdinand, I took great pleasure in watching him develop. But that nagging thing in my mind, I've got to play football. I've got to get games in. And I'm thinking, I've got to get away. I've got to get away. I've got to get playing. I've got to get games under my belt. And that always drove me on. Like,
your time at QPR, though, does bring us our final question from a listener. This one via Twitter. Timmy Coffey. He says, I saw Gerry play for QPR reserves in the 90s where he was hassled whilst getting treatment on the pitch by the ref, in brackets about being paid for sitting down. He then proceeds to score a cracking goal, then told the ref, that's what I get effing paid for, then got sent off. Is this the truth or is it an urban myth? I don't know.
It's the truth.
It is the truth.
Yeah, it's the truth. I was playing for... playing the reserve game, and in that team we had Bradley Allen was playing, and Bradley was a young striker at the time but good finisher, and he got smashed by the centre half. And like, I'm the enforcer anyway, so I'm like, referee, you can do something about it. He gets smashed again. Referee, sort it out, will you? What are you going to do? I said, I'll sort it out instead then. So I smashed the centre half anyway. We're both sitting on the floor, and I'm getting treatment, but there's nothing wrong with me. But the centre half knows now we're in a battle. So referee being clever goes, oh, is that what you get paid to do, number nine? So I'm fuming. So the game carries on. Within about 2 minutes, ball gets played in. I outpaced the centre half, outpaced him. I've read the situation, got there before the centre half, edited it past the keeper. And I turned around, he's there, and I went, no, that's what I get paid to do, you. And next thing, he's pulled the cards out and he sent me off. And I've gone, you are. He went, get off. So I've got off, like, now I'm in trouble. Because Jerry had said to me, he needed me fit because we were playing Man United about in 10 days' time. It was the Christmas period. So he said, need you to get fit, big man, get 60 minutes under your belt, get this game done, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I've been sent off now, so I've got a problem. So I walk off, like, how am I going to get out of this? So I think, right, I'll have a quick shower. Then, like, I'll waffle my way through it. I walk in, Jerry's already down there, Frank Sibley. What happened, big man? So now I'm writing it. So I got a lie. So I'm like, well, not lie, but admit the truth. So I said, well, the referee says to me, like, when I was having treatment, he's like, we get paid to do, number nine. I says, anyway, picture the scene. A couple of minutes later, ball comes in, I score. I says, no, that's what I'm getting paid to do. And he went, get off. I says, as I was talking, he was getting the cards out. And Frank Sibley went, I saw it. He couldn't wait to send you off. I'm going to go see him. Now, the referee will never let you into the dressing room, the referee's room anyway. So I know Frank's not going to get any joy there. I went, yeah, you tell him he's out of order. Jerry's looking at me. Jerry's known me since I was a kid. Jerry went, is that all that happened? Gaffer, as far as I remember, that's all I said to him. Like, so I think I've got away with it. I've gone in for the shower. I come out of the shower and Andy Impey, who ended up playing for Leicester, and Carl Reddy, who was at QPR for a good long time, they're the young kids. So Andrew Impey's talking. He says, oh, it's so funny, you know, because the referee went, is that what you get paid to do, number nine? And then Tomo scores a goal. And he goes, no, that's what I get paid to do, you. He's telling the story. He's like, oh, it's brilliant. Tomo burnt him. And standing behind him was Frank Sibley. And Frank went, oh, is that what happened? And I went, Frank, it sounds bad. And Jerry just walked over and went, you're fine, 2 weeks' wages. Fast forward 2 weeks later, I'm at home because I'm obviously suspended at that. QPR player scores 3 goals at Old Trafford against Man United, Dennis Bailey. That could have been me. Although I tell people, yeah, that would have been me. Probably wouldn't have been, but yeah. the story ties in nicely. Like, but yeah, that is the truth. That happened. So my own mouth got me in trouble yet again.
Lastly, you've written the book just after a very difficult period, unfortunately, as we get older, you know, we lose more people around us. And did the book help in any way with these losses? Did it give you a distraction, a focus to help you work your way through this period?
It helped me work my way through the period. It was a great distraction. When I started, it was a bind. When I got into it, it was quite cathartic. I ended up having counselling at the same time, and I was telling her about the book, and she said, it's good for you to unburden your soul and say all the things that you want to say. And I found it brilliant. I felt better once I started telling things. I got stuff off my chest and how I felt. And a lot of it I stored up, because she said to me, how have you grieved for Louise? How have you grieved because I lost Louise, my first wife? How have you grieved for your brother? And when I thought about it, all I did was just keep going. Next day, get on with it. And she said, it's like a kettle. You can't keep filling it with water. It's going to overflow. You've got to let it out. And I've learned to cry. I've learned to show me emotions. I've learned to tell people when I'm not happy. I've instead of just being a big, rough man who never shows any emotion, or like, I've learned to just be open. And like, my kids now know that, their dad can cry. Their dad can fall down, but he will get up again. But things do go wrong in life. But yeah, I learned an awful lot. The book and the counselling helped me so much. And I was so snobby about it at the beginning. What do I need counselling for? I used to set it for Aston Villa. But I've realised that more than ever, I probably needed counselling. It's all right laughing and joking all the time about things, but there are some serious issues that I need dealing with. And I've dealt with them and I feel a lot better person for it. I'm delighted that they did. They helped me. I'm proud to write the book, but I'm so delighted that people thought I was worth giving their time to and helping through a very difficult period.
Tell us where people can find the book, Gary, and tell us where people can find you on social media.
On social media, you can find me on at Thompson1. Is it at Thompson1 Twitter?
Let me find it for you. Hang on. I think.
I'm sure it's at Gary Thompson1.
It's or something. At Thompson1 Gary.
And That's the one.
Well worth a follow. And your publisher at Curtis Sport. I'm assuming people can buy the book directly through the Curtis Sport website as well. I'll stick the link in the show notes. And I really do appreciate your time, Gary. It's a very honest book.
Full time. Thank you to Gary Thompson. There's definitely a touch of the naughty Grainshaw pupil about Gary. And yet, if you're of a certain vintage, as I'm sure you are, you can't help but have empathy or even a lump in your throat when you hear or read of the big personal losses Gary has suffered in his life. Unfortunately, that's part of life for all of us. But it sounds, thankfully, like with professional help and no end of personal determination, which he exhibited during his career, Gary has worked his way through those losses in a way that enables him to move on through life, able to carry them in a way that doesn't cripple him emotionally. And I think that's a lesson for all of us. We need to remember those people. We need to find a way of trying to remember those people in the way that they deserve to be remembered and live our lives never forgetting them, but also at the same time trying to look forward. Links to Gary's Twitter and book will be in the show notes, but I'll give them out again here. Twitter, Thompson1Gary, that's Gary with two R's, and it's the number one, Thompson1Gary. Gary's book, Don't Believe a Word, is available from Curtis Sports and elsewhere online, as well as all good bookshops. And it has a brilliant cover. Illustrations of all of Gary's club shirts are on there. We didn't cover his time at Cardiff and Northampton simply because they were outside of the show's 1954-92 window. That's it for this week. The podcast can be followed on both Twitter and Instagram at Shorts with Short. You can follow the podcast on Facebook when Shorts with Short 2023. If you want to join that group page, please do. There's a few more followers on there this week. And also, please feel free to post on there. The only criteria is that the shorts should be short. That's our historical window. The show is, of course, also on Threads at Shorts with Short. If you want to drop the show an email, you can get me, shortswithshort@1607westegg.com. Support the work at ko-fi.com/Daniel Ruiz Tyson. That's kilooscar-foxtrotindia.com/Daniel Ruiz Tyson. Everything comes back into the show. All these links are available in the show notes. Thank you for your time. I've been Daniel Ruiz Tyson. This has been When Shorts Were Short. If the shorts weren't short, we don't talk about it.